Blog Talk Radio.
No.
back. That's just how I do, do, I do. I'm young right now, but I won't be forever. So I'ma live it up like that's true. You might wanna fall with me too, but I don't mean to brag. But I live a life that most can only dream about, yeah. So baby, come be my dream girl. Pick up fantasy and let me work out, yeah. Oh yeah. Tell me where you wanna go, what you wanna do. Said we living it like we own it, own it, own it. Said I'm on top of the world, what I need is you. Said we living it like we own it, own it, own it, yeah. Never too much, so just let the drinks flow. Later on you can come through, through, come through. You know you're the flyest. They should call you your highness. They call me king cause I'm that dude. All you gotta do is leave your crew. Said I don't need to brag, but I live a life that most can only dream about, yeah. So baby, come be my dream girl. Pick up fantasy and let me work out, yeah. Oh yeah. Tell me where you wanna go, what you wanna do. Said we living it like we own it, own it, own it. Said I'm on top of the world, what I need is you. Said we living it like we own it, own it, own it,
fly. It's Rick Ross. L.A. Reed flow right here. Now you're whining. Hold up. Sometimes I rhyme slow, sometimes I rhyme quick. Sometimes I buy flow, so I supply bricks. Motherfuckers looking at me sideways, but can they tell that I'm getting money by way? Lot of leather wood and it's vibrate. Chatting with a bitch like your boy on my space. But she right here in my face. Take her to a fly place with a fly fireplace. No marshmallows, we had a troll burn. I done seen the world, girl, it's your turn. I told you lies all my life, but you pulled me down on the ride. So it's only right she get that Porsche truck. All black, black rims on a Porsche. Let your weed blow in the wind, cause believe every deed, boy, I need a friend.
And can we get away and enjoy yourself? Get away and explore yourself. All I wanna know is can we get away and extend yourself? Can we ride like a movie screen? All I really
wanna
get away.
I'm in the heavy dough, I don't kiss every hoe. So when I like a bitch, I enlist Mario. Feet Mario's, ever glowing. Glory, that's the fine Emilio. Baby Billy though, that's your best bet. It'll be 6 O's in my next check. With a gun in hand, I always been a money man. Crack running man, fat running Cunningham. Look kid, I'ma tell you like this. We need time just to kick it like this. She licking my lips, she digging my kicks. So we did it like this, it's Rick Ross. I'm the man to the hour. She love to make love and we can't in the shower. Back against the wall, I'ma stand like a tower. Every time I'ma stand like a tower. Sometimes I rhyme quick, sometimes I buy blood, so I supply brick. You can't look me in the face, girl. When you're wrong, I'ma put you in your place, girl. My money long, I got money just to waste, girl. My money home and it's up to my waist, girl. I really love how you shake, girl. You're like a phantom, I love how you shake, girl. Rick Ross, I'm a real nigga. You can feel the realness when I deal with you. Baby, I won't lie to you. I'm too honest, I promise I won't lie to you. That other bitch finished with. You the one I'm having dinner with. And it's candlelit. Can you handle it? Cause I can handle it. Well, let's handle this.
Baby squirrel, use a sexy motherfucker.
Give me your, attention, baby. I gotta tell you a little something about yourself. You're wonderful, flawless, who you a sexy lady. But you walk around here like you wanna be someone else. Ooh, oh, I know that you don't know it, but you're fine, so fine. Fine, so fine. Show you when you're mine, oh mine, mine, mine.
Treasure, this is what you are. You're my golden star. You can make my wish come true. Would you let me treasure you? Would you let me treasure you? Oh, oh.
Peace. Welcome to Tuesday, December 31st, day before New Year's. Welcome to High Frequency Radio. This is your host, Brother Sharif. Welcome to the show. Hope all is well. I have some great information to share with the audience. We have some announcements as well to make today. The call-in number is 424-222-5250. 424-222-5250. Call in to get your questions answered. Dial 1 to be placed in the queue to have any questions addressed. Comments or concerns will be taken. Try to keep your questions short, precise, and to the point. Don't tell us the whole story. Just give us the specifics, and we'll try to give you an adequate answer for you to be able to obtain some relief from your situation. Again, the calling number is 424-222-5250. 424-222-5250. The email address for High Frequency Radio is highfrequencyradio@gmail.com. HighFrequencyRadio@gmail.com. Brother Sharif can be reached directly at thelawmaster44@yahoo.com. thelawmaster44@yahoo.com. Get on both of those email addresses. Just send us an email and request to be added to the mailing list. That way you'll be provided with any information, webinars, seminars, or any type of events that might be going on here at High Frequency Radio. And with Brother Sharif, your host here today. So go ahead and get on those email addresses. Consultations are available from myself by reaching me at thelawmaster44@yahoo.com. You can receive a private consultation about your personal matter, and that's available based on schedule. All right. We're going to go in today, as we usually do, on debt collecting, foreclosures, things of that nature. We'll discuss a lot of information here about your personal debt matters, and hopefully it will uplift your education in those particular areas and provide you with some type of enforcement or action that you can take on your own. We'll be back in 1 minute to get the show started. Enjoy the music. Okay, we're back. Let's get started. Let me get my introduction music together so I can come to the ring and let's get after these debt collectors.
Let's get ready to rumble!
All right, we're going to get ready. I see we have a bunch of callers in queue. Press 1 if you have a question, and I'll be able to get you at the top of the hour here. I'm going to go over some information today. I'm going to talk about some foreclosure actions. I'm going to read to the listening audience a foreclosure complaint that I was sent by a listener. And I'm going to dissect that complaint so others that are experiencing foreclosures judicially may be able to read and understand and point out the different defects, both material and latent defects, that exist with these foreclosure complaints. So I'm going to dive into one of the complaints that I received, and I'm going to let the audience know what to look for in those complaints, what's good, what's not, what's provable, what's not, what's evidence and what is not, and what is a complaint and what is not. Again, highfrequencyradio@gmail.com is the email address. Email there to get on the mailing list for any type of information you may receive from High Frequency Radio and Brother Youssef, as well as myself. Get on my email mailing list at thelawmaster44@yahoo.com. All right? And the calling number again is 424-222-5250. Press 1. If you have a question, you'll be placed in queue. I have a big announcement to make today that will be of huge interest to most of our listeners and those who have participated in any of Brother Sharif's webinars. I am myself and our priest and brother Elishua, those who do not know him, he was the individual that was on my show probably about 3 weeks to a month ago. Very strong, powerful, spiritual, knowledgeable brother, not only in law, but in the Bible. And we will be hosting a webinar together, both of us, on January the 11th, which is Saturday, at 10 a.m. I will warn you in advance, you need to go ahead and reserve your seats for this webinar. It will fill up very, very quick. The webinar for my portion of it, which will be half of the webinar's time, will go into how to handle court appearances with testimony, affidavits, the rules of evidence, okay? And I will be dealing with that portion of it for the first segment. And then the second segment will be our priest and brother Elishua, who handle and cover the puritanical defenses and approaches one may take in court by utilizing the Bible, okay, and how to communicate using natural law defenses to any kind of debt collection situation. So those of you who didn't listen to my show, you need to go back into the archives and listen to our priest Elishua. He was an individual that was considered or affectionately named a sovereign citizen in the state of Georgia. He was arrested and incarcerated for almost 2 years for claiming a strip mall and a couple of other high-end properties using legal processes available, but that the public wants to be unknown to us. He was arrested. He was charged with crimes, some of which were RICO. And he stayed in jail 2 years, and the man beat the state of Georgia and all their power, all of their financial power, all of their legal power, and he was able to dissect their criminal complaint and charge and walk out of jail after 2 years with the jury finding him not guilty. Understand that other individuals that was arrested with him had taken pleas, pled out. Some of them are incarcerated and will be for anywhere from 5 years, I believe, up to 10 years. So our brother Elishua did this, and he shared with us some of which how he did it. And a lot of it was marinated in the puritanical approaches, biblical approaches, and religious approaches that are available to everybody out there. So I thought it would be best for him to share those things, those biblical terms, those passages in the Bible, and I will share your knowledge of how to conduct yourselves when you are faced with a hearing, which some of us have a fear of. So we want to go ahead and give you that power, and we will do so January 11th, 2014, 10 a.m. Please sign up for that webinar. There will be roughly about 25 seats, and they will go quick. So go ahead and sign up for that webinar. You will receive some information if you're on the mailing list of the particulars of that webinar, but it will be a huge, profound, and very, 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 very popular webinar, and it's here for the high-frequency radio listeners. Okay. As far as announcements go, last week I talked about processes that a lot of us are exposed to, and a lot of these processes includes but are not limited to EFT processes, UCC processes, bonded promissory notes, UCC notes. There is a variety of titles named that supposedly and purportedly allows one in a self-serving fashion and manner to discharge debt, okay? That debt being credit card, mortgage, automobile, and things of that nature. I put out a call upon the radio last week, someone or someone's to call in and explain those processes to me, because although I've heard them many times, I haven't heard of much success on a continuing basis. But I put out the call last week and said that, you know, I think most of it is something that I'm not saying that it's not legal necessarily or lawful. What I'm saying is that it doesn't work. And if it does work, it's sporadic. It is here and there. There's no enforcement action behind it. There is no private right of action behind it. To my knowledge, there is no self-serving way to rid yourself of debt other than, one, to pay it if you have a legitimate debt, or, okay, to discharge it by using a court of competent jurisdiction to do so. So I received several emails, some interesting ones, some that wasn't interesting and didn't address my question. And as a people, we have a bad habit providing good answers to questions that are not asked of us. And these type of flaws in our communications is what allows these debt collectors, these legal societies, to absolutely dominate us economically. Because we don't listen, we don't answer, and we don't answer questions that are asked, or we don't ask the proper questions. And one of the things Brother Sharif believes in is effective communication. You listening to questions, you providing answers to that question, or if you have the need to, understanding and having the ability to dance around a question strategically. Okay, and there are ways by which one can do that. There are several ways by which one can do that. So we have to learn that art, and that's an art that I plan on continuing offering to the high-frequency radio listeners and to people that contact me, even if it is nothing but an email communication. For those of you who have received communications from me, my communications are very clear and they're precise. But many times I will questions, even on this show, and through emails, and we have the ability to not answer the question or answer too much to the question or not answer the question at all. And we must learn to effectively communicate, because the things you say and don't say are reasons why we're getting judgments put against us, losing our homes, losing debt collection cases, and things of that nature. So our communications need to be effective. They need to be precise. They need to be direct. They need to be clear. And the beginning of that would be in how you call on the show and how you ask and frame, which is the legal word for it, your question, okay, or frame your answer, all right? We must learn to be legal wordsmiths, similar to what the legal society does, and listen to the words that they use and be able to read and be able to understand what someone is saying and what they're not saying, or if they're not saying anything at all, which I'm going to share with you some information that will mirror just that, showing you how a paragraph of legal jargon or legalese will be saying a whole lot of nothing, okay, or will conflict or contradict or collide with each other and result in an explosion of nothing but garbage. All right, so we will go over that today. Again, call in 424-222-5250. And again, those of you, I received some responses on these processes, EFT, I've heard of accept the deed, bonded promissory notes, UCC procedures, bonds for this and bonds for that, and, you know, all this other stuff. And I don't know where this information is coming from. I know it doesn't come from this show, although our host, Brother Youssef, teaches on different concepts. I've listened to those concepts, and they are done so very meticulously, and they're done so under the banner of being a private person, okay, not a public person. So there is a really great deal of us mixing the two, and we're bringing private processes into the public, and we're bringing public processes into the private. So we must learn to not only listen, but to research ourselves and not just take what we say, either as myself or Brother Savage or Brother Youssef. We have to study and understand where those processes and when those processes and how those processes are executed, okay? And from what I see, as a people, as a nation, as a public, we just tend to latch on to anything that sounds good, and we start throwing it out there and utilizing it, not knowing that it's, one, maybe hurting us, okay, down the road. When you actually come into the correct information that you're able to use, you have this muddy record of sending in some Patriot documents or some self-serving, self-executing nonsense that will get you nowhere. Again, if I can't find it in a law library, in a law book, or there's not a federal or state law that supports these processes, they mean absolutely nothing to me. If there's not a liability clause based on them not doing one thing or another that attaches a monetary damage to it, I can't do anything with it, and I won't pay attention to it because it means absolutely nothing to me. So, again, call in. I've received some information in emails that, well, yes, Brother Sharif, EFT process works, and I've done one or two, or I've gotten a satisfaction of mortgage, or, you know, I was able to obtain a court order. I haven't received that information yet, and I've requested it. And then I've gotten some emails that say, yeah, well, one or two went through, but seven or eight people got arrested because of it, so we shut it down. And I've heard the same about OIDs and those other processes that people have participated in, some of which have resulted in prison time and loss of possessions and things of that nature. I'm not saying that any of these things are illegal, and I'm not saying that they are legal. There is a lot of legality and lawful ways to go about things. But I tend to focus on the things that work, okay? There's a lot of people out there that's been harmed or damaged by natural people and by artificial entities, i.e. banks and debt collectors and legal societies. And they're absolutely right. But one must understand that, you know, you just don't win on the facts alone, okay? You win on the politic of the situation, and we'll get into that, what that is, all right? So I tend to focus on things that work. I'm not saying that OIDs, if you've done those, are not correct within the IRM or the Internal Revenue Code. And I don't deal with those issues, but I'm just speaking about things that we have all heard of and been privy to. Some of them, I was speaking to someone the other day. They were speaking about an internal revenue situation they had with an OID, and I tell people, listen, you can get a check. Sure, you can submit that information and get a check, but where will you be after that check is cashed is a different story, okay? The government is not going to allow us to all get rich, okay, by filing some documents. It's just unfortunate. But that's just not the way things work. So, yeah, there may be some doors open and a few people might have gotten through, but the door will quickly close once they realize that the information is out. So is that right or wrong? That's not a battle that I don't think any of us are going to win. What I try to win on is showing you how to use your consumer protection laws and other strategies to be able to conquer your debt situation or to be able to neutralize it or set off some of that debt if it is indeed a genuine, legitimate debt. Okay, so if you have information about those processes, because many times when I speak to people in consultation or even privately through emails, I hear a lot of these processes coming about. And the people that speak about them with such conviction and confidence. And I ask them the question all the time, well, you sent the variety of these processes out. Why are you contacting me about the debt which is still withstanding? And the answer to that usually is silence. But that's okay. You know, because I understand that there is a language called silence, and I understand when to use it, but I don't think the people I'm asking these questions of are using a language of silence to get ahead. I think they're using it because they just don't have an answer for it, and they just don't understand. Well, if you don't understand it, then why are you doing it? Why are you sending these documents out? Why are you executing these procedures if you truly indeed don't understand it? Speaking of understanding, why are you filing lawsuits against debt collectors and you don't understand what you're doing? I've been reading a few articles lately that addresses, it was a Supreme Court, I don't know which Supreme Court, and I don't know if it was a U.S. Supreme Court, but there was a Supreme Court ruling based on the amount of FDCPA, FCRA, consumer protection complaints, there has been a surge in them, partly due to shows like this and others that are out there, groups that are out there that are utilizing the consumer protection laws. I did not Christopher Columbus these laws, meaning that I did not discover them. They've been there. Okay, I have an understanding of them. I've used them. I still use them, and that's what I do. But there is a lot of groups out there that are explaining to people or showing people how to execute and how to demonstrate obtaining some relief using your consumer protection laws. Just like we do with these EFT processes and accept the deed process and bonded promissory notes, many of us are taking other people's complaints and we're putting our names in them and we're going ahead and we're filing lawsuits in federal court against attorneys and debt collectors and we have no clue what we're doing. So the Supreme Court made a recent ruling that if you file a FDCA complaint, okay, and it was done erroneously and it was done grudgefully, oh, it was done not properly, okay, you can be subject to attorney's fees, and they can be excessive because, as you know, attorneys charge anywhere from $300 to $500, $600 an hour, all depending on which firm, all right? So you have to be careful, and I want to make that clear, that what we do on this show is to educate you, and you should not take an action unless you fully understand what you're doing, meaning you have taken the time to understand your local rules, civil rules of procedure, okay? For those of you who don't know what that is, those are the rules governing litigation, what you have to do as a plaintiff, what you have to do as a defendant, the time frames, how your complaint is drafted, okay? Whether you what state are you in? Are you in a notice pleading state or a fat pleading state? We'll go into those things here today. Okay, so understand that you must know what you're doing or have the support of a group or someone that knows what they're doing to be able to coach you or consult you down that road. Do not go out there filing complaints against debt collectors, even if you're right, but not know how to litigate and prosecute those claims. That is going to be a big mistake. It may be costly for you. And understand that now everybody is becoming aware of the consumer protection laws and the type of teeth that it has, then a lot of people are filing them. Okay, and when I say filing lawsuits, I don't care if it's even in the small claims court, because you can be held liable for attorney fees in small claims. Don't think small claims is some sort of a nursery where you can go in there and not know what you're doing and not know what you're saying and not know how to plead. It's no different. You might have an attorney, if your state allows, come in there and defend a debt collector in a suit that you prosecuted or you filed, and that attorney might be able to give you the business and ask for attorney fees for having to give you the business because your complaint is not properly drafted, it doesn't contain any facts, and you don't know how to litigate. So this is education, what we do here. This is not a 1-2 webinar and then you're ready to go and sue somebody. No, the most you will get out of 1 or 2 seminars, the most you will get out of it. And this all depends on your ability to retain information and your ability to research, okay? Some people learn quicker than others. But the most you will be able to do out of these shows in a short period of time is to communicate with debt collectors. Okay, be that a qualified written request, if you had a true legitimate mortgagee in front of you, and also a dispute of debt, okay, if you're dealing with the debt collector. Those kind of communications you should be able to gain within a couple of webinars and by listening to a couple of shows here on High Frequency Radio. But I do not think that anyone will be able to, inside of a month, be able to gain all the knowledge that they need to be able to go prosecute or litigate a lawsuit against a debt collector. You have to gain your knowledge, and we have to stop being so quick to accept what we see, what we read, the newest document floating around the internet. Listen, if there is a document free on the internet that would allow you to get rid of a $300,000 mortgage, I'm going to be honest with you. I love you guys. I wouldn't be on the call, okay? I just wouldn't be. I'd probably be teaching at some point, but I'm telling you right now, it would be hard for me to get on this call for 4 hours for free and go through all of this, okay? And I've been around a while, so let's just stop with the process and the scams, and let's stop believing it, and let's stop executing those things unless we fully understand what we're doing. Okay, again, you can be liable for attorney's fees and cost for filing a lawsuit that is not in compliance with civil rules of procedure. Speaking of civil rules of procedure, you have to learn also, if you went into the federal court, your federal rules of civil procedure. You have to learn those rules as well, or be understanding of them, knowing when to file a complaint, how to serve a summons, knowing how to defend a motion to dismiss, knowing how to defend a demur, knowing when to do your Rule 26 conference, okay, knowing when to do discovery, knowing when to file a motion for summary judgment, okay, knowing when to file or how to file, okay, a motion for production of documents. Those things you have to learn, and you have to take out the time to learn it, okay? Let's not be so quick to jump on things until we've mastered it, because once you've mastered this information, it will last you a long time. Debt is not going anywhere. Mortgages are not going anywhere. Automobile loans are not going anywhere. Credit cards are not going anywhere, okay? So you have time to be able to gain the knowledge and experience and education to be able to deal with debt for the rest of your life. So invest in the time. Many of us don't seem to have the desire to really learn much. We want to ask questions and get immediate answers. We in that microwavable society. We want it, and we want it now, which is why the legal society thrives so much, because we want to be able to learn everything immediately. We want to be able to get instant gratification. So we don't want to invest in the education, okay? Meaning that we don't want to put the time in. But we've been to college, all right? We went to college 4 years, paid $200,000, $300,000, acquired so much debt during college, okay, made some people rich, okay? We've done all of those things and for so long and paid for it, and most of you are still paying for it, but we don't want to invest 2 or 3 months or 6 months into learning the consumer protection laws and learning some legal foundation enough for you to be able to go into a small claims court or federal court and prosecute some consumer violations. It is not difficult to do. It takes a little bit of time and dedication and reading, okay, which is what most of us seem to be scared of. Why are we afraid of reading? There's a saying that for us, okay, and they reference black people, and I don't know what black people is. I don't know of anybody that's considered black. I don't know of a country called black. I don't know of a language called black. I've seen a color black, but I haven't seen anybody that is of the color black. Now, I've seen some people that are considered blue-black, which is dark, brothers and sisters, close to black, but not black. And I'm being funny there. But, you know, we have to learn those things, and we have to learn enough to be able to defend ourselves or go on the offensive against someone that's coming after us and appears to have violated several laws while doing so. Understand that these consumer protection laws, specifically the FDCPA, the FCRA, okay, they are specifically related to the behavior of the debt collector. It has nothing to do with the validity of the alleged debt. In other words, a creditor can violate the FDCPA, okay, and they do at times, all right? So when you go into that situation, you're only speaking about the actions of the debt collector while attempting to collect that debt, okay? You don't have to talk about the debt at all. Okay, or if you want to be funny or sarcastic, as sometimes I am, I'll be like, okay, you have a legitimate debt or you have a genuine debt, but while trying to collect that debt, you violated these provisions of 15 U.S.C. 1692 or 1681 or the TCPA. Okay, so let me humor you and tell you that, okay, let's say you got a good debt, but either I have some set off or I'm going to collect those damages. You're trying to collect a $500 debt. I'm saying that you now owe me $10,000 for your violation. So once you and I settle up and you give me the $10,000, I'll tip you and give you your $500 amount of your alleged debt just to make it seem like you won something. Okay? Of course, I'm being facetious, but I'm being dead serious because that's how you're supposed to treat this situation. It's not about the debt, and I want everybody to understand that and don't fall into the trap of talking subject matter when it doesn't apply. I don't care about the debt. You got to understand most attorneys are going to plead things to get to see which disco light you're going to pick to dance under. Okay, so they'll say things hoping that you follow their trail as opposed to standing on your square and sticking to your points. Do not get off track and get off point and start following some of the ignorant things and some of the irrelevant things that a law firm or debt society or attorney or debt collector may say. It's a language called silence. When they say something stupid, you can remain silent, okay? Okay, you can remain what they say in court as mute. It deserves no response. I don't even need to respond to that ignorance. It has no relevance. They haven't answered my question. But most of what which we do, which I complain about, that I asked them a specific question, and they haven't answered that question. Instead, they turned on the disco lights and trying to get me to turn around and dance with somebody else when I have somebody in front of me that I want to continue dancing with. And that's the judge by proving my case. Judge, they haven't answered my question. They haven't proved their debt. They haven't verified. They haven't validated. They haven't proffered any admissible evidence. They haven't proffered any competent fact witness. There's no declaration. I just don't have time to play games. If they can answer their question here today, I'll afford the time to play games with them. Other than that, when I dance, it's going to be in a club of my choice, not in a court. So let's stop dancing. Let's stop playing games, and let's get to the nitty-gritty. All right? I'm going to go into and read a complaint that I received, and it's for all of those that are in the New York area, okay? New York, as you know, is a foreclosure, a judicial foreclosure state, and it's also the home of Wall Street. It's also the home of most of the securitization trusts that exist were formed under New York trust law. That's just some information for you to know. All right. Before I start reading this complaint or parts of it, I want to go over a couple of things that we must understand. And that is, and I read it last week and I will read it again. Okay. And that is the difference in a holder, okay, H-O-L-D-E-R, and holder in due course. Okay. This is the meaning of holder in due course. All right. The meaning of holder in due course is holder means any person entitled in his own name to the possession of the negotiable instrument and to recover or receive the amount due thereon from the parties thereto. Okay. Thereon, thereto. Don't pay attention. Those are just catchy phrases. Okay. Just eliminate the fancy words, the legalese for those of you who get intimidated. That's just, it means hardly nothing, okay? It's a transitional phrase, all right? A holder in due course, on the other hand, means a holder who takes the instrument in good faith for consideration before it is overdue and without any notice of defect in the title of the person who transferred it to him. Translation, what are you saying, Brother Sharif? A holder in due course is, in street terms, the money man, okay, money grip, all right? So that's the person who did the loan, who paid consideration for it. Notice that it includes the fact that he has to take it for consideration before it is overdue. Now, let me explain this to you. Most of you that are out there going through foreclosure, you will almost 99% of the time have a foreclosure complaint pleading in part that they are the holder. They will rarely, rarely state that they are the holder in due course. So being that they identify themselves as holder, let me tell you what a holder is. Let me finish telling you what a holder in due course when I speak about consideration. A person who claims to be the holder in due course, they must be able to show you, okay, understand this, that they acquired the instrument for consideration. The reason why I'm focusing on this is because when we're dealing with foreclosure these days, there are normally assignments. And I hear a lot of defenses about assignments, and I hear people focus on robo-signing and all that stuff, and the courts really don't care who signed it. Okay, that what they want to know is that did you get a loan? Are you in default? And you have to learn how to defend that and stop focusing on robo-signing. It's good to mention, but it's not. They're not going to relieve you of a $300 debt because somebody else executed the signature or signed. Well, now, with a combination of other defenses you might have, yes, okay, when you have 8 or 9 defenses, that may equate to one big defense that the court or the judge can grasp his hand around or his mind around to be able to say, yes, I understand what they're saying. Okay? So consideration. Most of these assignments says for valuable consideration, but it doesn't specifically spell out the amount of the consideration. What is valuable consideration? Well, the answer to that in my determination is who knows? Okay? They never explain what valuable consideration is, all right? So in order for that person to be a holder in due course, which is the highest status, all right, they have to be able to show that they acquired the instrument for consideration. Okay? However, consideration may not pass from a holder of the instrument. Okay? So let's talk about what a holder is. Okay? A holder is just a person that's holding the instrument. Okay? So let's look at it. Holder of a negotiable instrument does not acquire a better title than that of the person from who he acquired the instrument. Now listen to that. Okay? So let's say you have a holder of a negotiable instrument. Let's say he acquired that holder from another debt collector. Okay? Through a MERS assignment. So did that holder acquire a better title than that of the person from whom he acquired the instrument? Well, if you acquired the instrument from MERS, you didn't acquire anything. Okay, because most of those MERS assignments are completely flawed. I don't care what the knucklehead judges say. 50 of them say it's flawed. 50 of them say it's not. Okay, these kind of rulings are designed to continue confusion. Okay, that's all they're designed for. How 50 human beings that purportedly went to the same law school, okay, got educated the same way, and supposedly are pure jurists, okay, how they come to conclusions that is outside of law, outside of logic, and many times outside of common sense, I just don't understand it, nor do I try to understand it. But this is what I do understand. The more confusion and ambiguity there is, the more people will lose their homes. Okay, understand that the legal society gets paid off of confusion. Those of you who have ever been through a divorce, what's the first thing that happens? She gets an attorney, you get an attorney, the attorneys tell you, don't talk to each other, leave them alone. They're a piece of crap, she's a piece of crap, and you start telling all, he was bad, or she was this and she was that, and now they've created the division. Okay, and through the division, they're able to say, pay me 10 grand. The other attorney might say, pay me 20 grand because you might get more. Okay, so the confusion benefits of the court system and the attorneys, okay, and only works against you. You have to stick to the facts. Okay, so a holder in due course can sue all prior parties to a negotiable instrument until the instrument is satisfied, whereas a holder of the instrument can enforce it against the person who has signed it and also against the transfer or from whom it obtained it. All right? So now you understand what the difference is of a holder and a holder in due course. A holder is just a holder. I can give you something to hold. That doesn't mean you can do anything you want with it. Who are you holding it for? Okay? It's simple. You're not the holder in due course. Due course means you're not entitled to payment. You're holding it for somebody. All right? Who are you holding it for? So let me go into a foreclosure complaint. For those of you in New York experiencing foreclosure, you know that you will get, they use the title Supreme Court, although it's not a Supreme Court by way of its jurisdiction. That's what they entitled their state courts, is a Supreme Court, all right? And you know it's a judicial foreclosure, all right? And meaning that they have to file a verified complaint. Okay, meaning it has to be verified. Okay, not just the complaint, a verified complaint. All right? And I want to start off, and then, you know, you get served, and, you know, if you're served properly pursuant to the rules of procedure, which is CPLR in New York, okay, or your local rules, or your federal rules of civil procedure, whichever court you are in, normally if you have a foreclosure, it will more than likely be in the state court. Okay? So I want to read with you, there's a requirement in New York that the courts put out that was supposed to be some sort of a penalty or warning to the legal society and the attorneys to curb the robo-signing and fraudulent documents and things of that nature. So they came out with this verification. And the verification is to be made by the attorney prosecuting the foreclosure. All right, and they made this law or this act under CPLR 2106. And what it was supposed to be some deterrent to attorneys not providing the court with robo-signed documents, fabricated notes, fabricated mortgages, cut and paste put together documents and things of that nature, okay? So this is your Supreme Court, okay? These are your administrative head judges, chief judges, that said, hey, we're going to curb a lot of this nonsense. We're getting you where we're catching these guys doing all kind of illegal things and bringing all kind of frivolous lawsuits, and the integrity and reputation of the court is on the table, and we have to clean that up. And this is the way they were supposed to clean it up, by informing or putting up this guard or filter that would purportedly assert some sort of a violation or penalty against any law society or law group or an attorney or law firm that was bringing these type of actions to the court, all right? And that's what it's called. It's a verification. This is what attorneys have to file along with the foreclosure case, all right? And I'm going to read it to you, and I'm going to read it twice, all right? What it says is that it'll have the name of the attorney hereby affirms under the penalties of perjury. Now, when we hear that, we be like, whoa, all right, that's serious, okay, under the penalties of perjury, all right? As you know, perjury can carry up to a 10-year sentence, okay, depending on your state, all right? But it says, hereby affirmed under the law firm, hereby affirms under the penalty of perjury and pursuant to CPLR 2106 that he or she is one of the attorneys for the plaintiff, that he or she has read the foregoing summons and complaint and knows the contents thereof, that the same is true to his or her own knowledge except as to matters stated to be upon information and belief, and as to those matters he or she believes them to be true. The grounds of his or her belief as to matters not stated upon his or her knowledge are statements and or records provided by the plaintiff, its agents or employees, and contained in the file in the attorney's office. This written verification is made pursuant to CPLR Section 3020D3, as the plaintiff is not in the county of whatever county you're in, Bronx County, Queens County, Richmond County, which is where plaintiff attorney office is located. I'm going to read that one more time so you can understand what this verification under penalty of perjury is saying. Of course, they named a certain law firm. They will say hereby affirms under penalty of perjury and pursuant to CPLR 2106 that he or she is one of the attorneys for the plaintiff. So he or she is swearing under penalty of perjury that he is an attorney. No big deal, right? Who cares? We know that, all right? That he or she has read the following summons and complaint and knows the contents thereof. Okay, so they're swearing under penalty of perjury that they read their own complaint that they drafted and they know the contents thereof. Big deal? Not at all. And this is what else they're swearing to, that the same is true to his or her own knowledge except as to matters stated to be upon information and belief. So in other words, he's still swearing that the information that he read, which is what his paralegal drafted up for the plaintiff, the summons and complaint, okay, he's swearing that he knows that to be the information that he drafted, okay? And except as to matters to be stated upon information and belief, when I read you the complaint, you will understand what information and belief is. It's just information and belief. I believe that I'm whoever I am. You might believe you're Superman. Doesn't make you Superman. All right? And that he says, except as to matter stated to be upon information and belief. So he doesn't swear under penalty of perjury that the information he stated in the complaint, which is upon information and belief, that he believes them to be true. He's just saying that's still information and belief. Those are just my information and belief. I can have defective information, bad information, fabricated information, forged information. I don't believe those to be true under penalty of perjury. That's just information and belief. But I'm going to show you how the complaint is nothing but hearsay and information and belief. Okay? Then it goes on to say the grounds of his or her belief as to matters not stated upon his or her knowledge are statements and or records provided by the plaintiff. So in other words, he's drafted a verified, okay, means it was verified complaint on behalf of a debt collector, mortgagee, whatever mask they're wearing at the time, usually it's a mortgagee mask or creditor or lender mask, okay? And he's saying that the grounds of his or her belief as to matters not stated upon his or her knowledge, in other words, for the information that's in the complaint, okay, that are statements and records provided by the plaintiff, he's not taking responsibility for. He said, I can't swear that that information is correct. But, again, he filed a verified complaint, okay? All right? So he's saying that all that information that the plaintiff gave me, I cannot swear under penalty of perjury that that information is correct. And then he goes on to say, this verification is made pursuant to CPLR 3020D3, okay? And he goes on. Now, when I tell you about a bunch of hogwash and about a bunch of not saying anything, this is a perfect example of what the courts put out there to be some sort of a filter or some sort of a prevention method to stop the flow of BS cases, cases that are really not supposed to be in a court of law, and had you or I filed it, they would immediately dismiss it under Rule 12b-6, okay, for failure to state a claim or some other reason, okay? So this is the verification that the attorneys in New York sign that's supposed to give some credibility or some oomph to the fact that they've done their job. This verification amounts to nothing. Okay, the attorney is saying nothing. Basically, he can file the complaint on information and belief, and that's what I believe to be true because I'm the attorney. And on the other information that the plaintiff gave to me, the robo-signed documents, the assignment, the forged note, the fabricated note, the cut-and-paste note, all the information that you're in default, and that they're the, listen, I'm not taking any responsibility for that under the penalty of perjury. I'm just saying that's what the plaintiff gave me. Okay, y'all understand that? All right, so that's what you're dealing with, this verification, and this was implemented by the courts, okay, is basically garbage. All right, let's move on to the complaint. Okay, this complaint was filed against someone in New York, okay, in the Supreme Court, State Supreme Court, okay, it's a name brand bank, Bank of America, okay, against the defendant, the homeowner, alleged defendant. All right, and I'm going to read you the certain parts I want to address here. All right, it says that plaintiff Bank of America, successor by merger to Bank BAC Home Loans, by and through its attorneys, whoever, complains and alleges upon information and belief. Now, this is the opening paragraph of the complaint. It says plaintiff Bank of America, by and through its attorneys, complains and alleges upon information and belief, no facts. Now, understand this, all right? There is certain states are notice pleading states, and certain states are fact pleading states. Explain, Sharif, all right? So notice pleading allows a party to basically state their claim in general terms, meaning that it doesn't have to be factually based, all right? It's a notice pleading. There's really a notice that, you know, you did this and you did that, and you may have did this and you may have did that, okay? So it's very open, wide open, general, okay? Fact pleading is you're pleading facts, short statement of facts. Let me tell you where that is usually done. Some state courts, depending on what state you are in, is a notice pleading state. And then there's some states that are fact pleading states. But at all times relevant, fact pleading is required in your district court. And when we talk about a lot of the things on this show, we talk about really taking your complaint because of the federal nature of it to the district court. So understand in the district court, you can't notice plead. You have to fact plead, okay? It has to be a short statement of the facts. In state court, you can just about say anything, and you can start off your complaint as this firm did and this bank by stating, hey, the information in this complaint is upon information and belief. I believe that I'm Superman, and I believe that I can jump off the building. That's an example of, you know, information and belief. Who can tell you what you believe and what you don't believe? How can you take someone's house based on information? Information from who? The chipmunks? How can you take someone's house based on information and belief? And if you are a debt collector in a bank, don't you believe you should be able to take the people's home? Don't you believe that you should get that $300,000 house? Of course you believe that. But if you're a defendant, you should believe that you should not be subject to that. Okay? All right. So let's move on. The complaint states. Let's take a break for 1 minute. I want to adjust some electronics here. We're going to take a short break, and I'll be right back where I left off.
Baby squirrel, use a sexy motherfucker.
Give me your, attention, baby. I gotta tell you a little something about yourself. You're wonderful, flawless, who you a sexy lady. But you walk around here like you wanna be someone else.
We're going to go on with the complaint. And again, this is a foreclosure complaint filed in New York Judicial Foreclosure State. And this is a foreclosure filed by Bank of America against a homeowner. So as I began, I told you that the complaint started off with the complaint. The bank, by and through its attorney, complains of and alleges upon information and belief as follows. This action is to foreclose a mortgage lien on the premises described herein. The plaintiff, listen closely, is the mortgagee and the holder, not holder in due course, of the subject note and mortgage, and if not, listen to this. And this is the opening. I mean, this is the entree. This is the opening gig, so to speak. This is the first page of the complaint, and already I have a complaint starting off with allegations, information, and belief, and this is the second paragraph of this complaint. The plaintiff is the mortgagee and the holder of the subject note and mortgage, and if not the owner. Okay? How can you be a mortgagee? Okay? A mortgagee what? Lends money, right? So how can you be the mortgagee and the holder, not the holder in due course? So in one sense, you're a mortgagee that lent money, then you're the holder of the note that you drafted or executed based on the fact that you lent money. And then it says, and if not the owner, I mean, how many contradictions can we have in one sentence? This is not, I mean, this sentence has a comma in it. It's not even the end of the sentence, and already I'm confused. Well, I'm not confused, but you would be, okay? And if not the owner has been delegated the authority to institute a mortgage foreclosure action by the owner and holder of the subject note and mortgage. Now, I'm going to read that to y'all one more time, and I'm not joking. I'm reading this from a foreclosure complaint done by a foreclosure law firm, okay, in the big state of New York. And the opening paragraph says that the plaintiff is the mortgagee and holder of the subject note and mortgage, and if not, okay, and this is a verified complaint. I don't know who they verified it with. Who do they verify it with? The bum on the corner? I don't know who they verified. Oh, they verified it with the debt collector. All right, that's why it sounds so convoluted. All right, the plaintiff is the mortgagee and the holder of the subject note and mortgage, and if not the owner. Although they said they were in the first four words of the sentence, they said they're the mortgagee, and they said they're the holder, not the holder in due course, all right, have been delegated the authority to institute a mortgage foreclosure action by the owner and holder of the subject note and mortgage. Well, which one are you? Are you the one that holds the note? Are you the mortgagee? Are you the holder? Are you the holder in due course? Have you been delegated the authority to institute a foreclosure action? Or it says, or you may, they may have been delegated that authority by the owner and holder. Well, they just said they were the holder and the mortgagee. I'm confused. So are you. Foreclosing party or creditor, this is still the first paragraph. Foreclosing party or creditor, note holder, they have in parentheses, directly or through an agent, has possession of the promissory note. Now, I'm confused. You said in the first paragraph, the plaintiff is the mortgagee and a holder of the subject note. Then further, two sentences down, you're saying that you might have possession or through an agent. Understand, we're dealing with a verified complaint here, so I don't understand why it's so ambiguous. Like, either you have the note or you're not. Either you're the mortgagee, the creditor, the lender, the holder in due course, or you're not. But again, they did tell us up front that complaint was based on information and belief of a debt collector. All right? So it says, directly or through an agent, they may have possession of the promissory note. And again, I'm not joking. This is what it says. All right? The promissory note is either made payable to the foreclosing party or has been duly endorsed. The promissory note, I'll say that again, is either, the word either. When we're reading law and complaints and pleadings, or if we're in court, I don't care if it's civil or criminal, what I've always been taught is the focus on the one word, Brother Sharif, that creates ambiguity or that has multiple definitions or may be taken or construed to be something else, okay? And that's what we have to do daily. I have to understand what you're saying. This complaint has told me five different things that this person might be. They may be a mortgager. They may be acting for themselves. They may be acting for somebody else. They own the note, but then they may have the note with an agent or somebody else somewhere. Okay? This is an attorney law firm that's drafted the complaint for a major conglomerate, a bank. And this is what they're saying. They've filed a lawsuit against someone, brought them to court, and the court has accepted this complaint in its entirety the way it is drafted. Understand, New York is a notice pleading, so they don't have to plead facts, but I just want you to know how the BS looks. All right, so the promissory note is either made payable to the foreclosing party or has been duly endorsed. What is that telling us? The promissory note is either made payable, either made payable to them or been duly endorsed. But then on the top, they said they were, if they're not the owner, they've been delegated authority by who? So who are they naming as the plaintiff if you've been delegated authority by somebody else that may be the holder in due course if you're just a holder? There's still a level above you. There's still a holder in due course. So if you're acting for that holder in due course pursuant to Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 17, you're not the real party in interest if you're acting for somebody else. I got to know who's bringing the action against me. Right? So in this first paragraph, they don't know who the hell they are. They're guessing, or they're hoping that you admit, like most of us do, or go in and be like, oh, man, the RoboSigned document, this and that. First of all, just on this paragraph, any decent attorney or first-year law student would be able to say, this is a bunch of crap. This is really not saying anything, or it's saying everything. Again, there's a terminology is throw a lot of crap up against the wall and see what sticks. So far, in the first page of this complaint, if you are decent-minded or if you are listening to this show, none of it should stick because I'm reading it the way you should understand it, and that's saying I'm confused. All right? So, or it says the note has been duly endorsed. Okay, what is duly endorsed? Endorsed to who? Mickey Mouse, King Kong, Africa? The Bar Society, the president, I mean, who has it been endorsed to? What does that say? Let's go further. It says, where applicable, the plaintiff has complied with all the provisions of the banking law and yada, 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 and they go on to, you know, state what they've done, that they've complied with, okay? And it says that the plaintiff at all times relevant was the corporation authorized to conduct business in the state of New York, and, you know, it goes on to describe the defendants and the parties and things of that nature, all right? So it starts off with this. On or about May 2005, the defendant, the homeowner, executed and delivered to Countrywide Home Loans a note whereby the defendant agreed to pay Countrywide Home Loans or its transferees the sum amount of $300,000 plus increases in principal, if any, with interest. All right, so that's what they're saying. Now, first of all, you're supposed to deny that because it says that, you know, they said that they executed, that Countrywide executed. But if you remember in the first paragraph, they said they were the mortgagee, which gives the inference that they made the loan. Okay, but then they said it was endorsed also, or they may be acting for somebody else. Well, we know they're not acting for Countrywide, but Bank of America was the successor in interest to Countrywide. Doesn't mean that they were the successor in interest to any loans that Countrywide made. All right? So basically in here, in the first beginning, they said they were the mortgagee, or might be working for the mortgagee, or they're the holder, or they're holding something for somebody, or, you know, they might be having it endorsed, or, you know, ambiguity, confusion. Okay? So here they're saying that, you know, allegedly that the homeowner got a loan from Countrywide in an amount of $300,000, and that note was executed and delivered. You need to deny that. All right? As collateral security for the payment of the note, the defendants executed, acknowledged, and delivered to MERS, Mortgage Electronic Registration System, as nominee for Countrywide, the amount of the note for $300,000. All right? So they go on, you know, with their gibberish. And it says the premises is encumbered by the said mortgages with all appurtenances thereto is bounded and fully described in the schedule. The note provides for payment, and they go on, the mortgage obligates the defendant. Okay, all these things you have to deny. Okay, deny that there's a mortgage, deny you ever got a loan. Okay, deny that you ever received a loan from Countrywide, because many of you don't know where your loan came from. Okay, you know what some documents said, but you don't have any proof that Countrywide funded or any other bank funded your loan. You have to know who funded your loan. It has to be specific. You have TILA laws. You have all kinds of laws that support the fact that you need to know who gave me the loan. And if the paper stated that you gave me the loan, but I found out you didn't, then that creates a problem, does it not? Okay. So it goes on and it says the note in the mortgage obligates the defendants to pay plaintiff reasonable attorney fees, which some of you need to read your deed of trust, okay? It says reasonable attorney's fees and costs in the event of a default. Most of your mortgages and deed of trust does not cover expenses. It does not name expenses. You have to be very careful with these foreclosure mills because they will put in their expenses. Okay, it doesn't say expenses, it says cost, all right? The cost, if it's a $300 filing fee, that's what you pay, $300, okay? Reasonable cost, and usually in judicial foreclosure states, that is determined by the court, not because the plaintiff wants $10,000 in attorney's fees. Let's go on. The defendants defaulted under the terms of the note and mortgage by omitting and failing to make monthly payments of principal and interest, an allegation upon information and belief. Again, this is a notice pleading state in New York, all right? No facts, all right? As a result of the defendant's failure to pay the obligation under the note, there is now due an owing amount owing to plaintiff on the principal of the mortgage in sum of $300,000. Notice that the amount they're saying that it's owed is the full amount, face amount of the alleged note, as if the defendant, the homeowner, never made a payment ever, okay? Did I say FDCPA 1692G? Verify and validate what you allege I owe. And you better be specific, and you better be on the nail. All right. In order to protect its security, the plaintiff may keep – listen to this. In order to protect its security, the plaintiff may be compelled during dependency of this action to pay sums for premiums on insurance policies, force place insurance. Y'all heard of that? Real estate taxes, assessments, water charges, sewer rents, which are or maybe become liens on the mortgage property and other charges which may be necessary for the protection of the mortgage premises. And the plaintiff prays that any sums or sums paid together with interest from the date of the payment shall be added to the plaintiff's claim and deemed secured by the said note and mortgage and adjudged a valid lien on the mortgage premises, and that the plaintiff be paid such sums along with interest therein out of proceeds of the sale of the premises. Do you see what they're doing there? So, well, this is why I tell people all the time, pay your taxes and get your own homeowner's insurance. Okay? Because just because someone comes in and pays your electric bill don't mean that they can cut your bill off. I can go downtown right now if you give me your name and I know your address, and if you owe $250 on your electric bill, I can pay it. That doesn't mean I can say, hey, turn it off. Okay? I can pay it. Okay? So these debt collectors will come in and they will pay your insurance and they will pay your taxes, all right, to imply some sort of an interest in your property, to play the role of a creditor when they're just a debt collector. Okay, understand, they only paid pennies on the dollar for the debt, 5 to 10%, so they can afford to pay a couple of $1,000 on your taxes to kind of act, fulfill the shoes of a mortgagee or creditor or lender, because that's what they would do. But they're not creditors or lenders. We know that. All right, the mortgage provides that in case of foreclosure, the mortgage premises may be sold in one parcel. All right? So they just go on with the gibberish and jabberish, and, you know, they say, you know, basically, you know, they say the plaintiff is entitled to this and the plaintiff is entitled to that. Now, understanding in the first part, they don't know who they are. They haven't they haven't done the one thing that Brother Sharif always preaches. They haven't specifically, clearly, and unambiguously identified themselves. They said they're the holder, they're the water boy, they're the point guard, they're southpaw. I mean, I don't know what they are. They might be acting for the creditor. They might be acting for somebody else. They might be acting for a debt collector. It's just clearly confusing as to what role they're playing. But in within their complaint, they say plaintiff is entitled to this and that and that and this. Okay. So in the beginning of the complaint, they don't know who of the complaint. They don't know who they are. But as the complaint progresses, They're taking their role. You can see them morphing into taking a role to say, I'm entitled to this, and I might have to pay that, and I might have to pay taxes, court, and I might have to do certain things that the creditor and a lender does. You know about that, court. You know what lenders do, but you're not a lender. You're a debt collector. All right? Let me get to the final part of it. All right? On the last page, interestingly enough, okay, when they start to pray for their relief, okay, this is the first part that they say that totally just made me laugh, okay? And when I was speaking with this homeowner, we both laughed because as I broke it down the way I'm breaking it down to you, she hadn't, although she's read this complaint, she was immediately jumping the subject matter. Oh, Brother Sharif, they didn't do that, and they didn't send me, and I said, what are you talking about? Have you read the complaint? There's no need for you even to say that. You ready to jump into subject matters, which is a mistake we all make. You simply say, I don't even understand what the complaint is saying. How can I mount a defense against such an ambiguous, cloudy, confusing, conflicting statement of hearsay? No facts. Upon information and belief of a debt collector and an attorney who just wants to get paid. Okay? They would say anything, wouldn't they, Judge? Of course. But this is where they went into, after they went into their whole dissertation about what they're entitled to and what they need from the court, the first thing they prayed for from the court, okay, is they said, plaintiff pursuant to Article 15 of the RPAPL, okay, requests judgment. Listen carefully, those of you in New York and abroad. Judgment declaring that the mortgage held by the plaintiff constitutes a valid first lien on the premises herein. Now, that particular sentence is very profound. They started off the complaint saying they were the holder, but they wasn't a holder. You know, they found it on the floor, or they found it in the garage, and then they may be acting for themselves, or they may be acting for somebody else. They're not sure. You know, you heard the attorney say he swears under penalty of perjury that he read the complaint, and that's what the plaintiff told him, which is of no probative value whatsoever. Okay? So what? You read the complaint that you wrote. What are you saying? So this is, again, this is implemented by the court. And then I'm going to read to you another document that came from the court to show you the complicity of these courts in aiding the theft of real property. All right? So the plaintiff, pursuant to Article 15 of RPAPL, requests judgment declaring that the mortgage held by the plaintiff constitutes a valid first lien. So they're asking the court for relief and for the court to say, that the plaintiff has a valid first lien. Now, let me ask you, why would a plaintiff who said in 10 different languages and in 10 different conflicting terms that they were the plaintiff entitled to the property, okay? Why would they need the court to adjudicate or declare judgment and a determination that their mortgage is a valid first lien? Why? Because it ain't valid. It isn't valid. They need the court to say that the loan is good, okay, and that it is a first lien. Now, why, if you are a creditor or a lender or a mortgagee, you would already know that your mortgage is a first lien. You would already know that you have a perfected, is the terminology used, lien. That means it was done proper. It's perfected. You can have a lien and it be unperfected, meaning that you missed a step in the process. Although you had a good loan, you didn't file your lien. In New York, first in line, first in time. Okay? So if you don't have a perfected lien, they're coming to the court now saying, hey, judge, can you just really make a determination that our lien is in first place? It's a valid first lien? But all throughout their pleadings, they're telling the court, we're entitled to that. They owe us money. I mean, they owe us the property. And I'm going to go into why they say they didn't owe money. Okay? So let's talk about that, okay, for a minute. All right? What this complaint does not have. First, let me explain to you, okay? If a lawsuit is on the loan of money, understand this, people. If a lawsuit is on the loan of money, the plaintiff must always state the ultimate facts upon which relief can be granted. Okay? They have to state some facts. Okay, you're in a notice pleading state. But they gotta come up with some facts. Or if you're listening to my show and if you've been studying, you will provide the facts. The facts, not the hearsay, not the information and belief. Okay? So they have to state the ultimate facts upon which relief can be granted. Okay? Including any factual circumstances of the loan and the fact that the loan was made. So they got to say that the loan was made. And they said that you executed a note and a mortgage, okay, in favor of Countrywide, but they didn't say that the loan was made by Countrywide. You got to look for what they don't say. Okay, so meaning they didn't plead any financial injury. They just said, hey, judge, this person got a loan from Countrywide, and, you know, we know Countrywide's out of business, and we know we might be working on behalf of ourselves or somebody else. We're not sure. It might have been endorsed properly. We might be holding it. We're not the holder in due course, so we're not the money man. We're saying that we want you to constitute this as a first lien, and then we've made no claim in our complaint that they suffered some sort of financial injury on the account of any breach by you. In other words, they didn't say, because this homeowner didn't pay their payments, they injured us, judge, to the amount of $300,000. So they didn't plead. They have a defective pleading just in that sense that they didn't plead a financial injury. Okay. Also, you got to understand the complaint must state some facts upon which relief can be granted that the plaintiff owns and holds the note. And that the defendant owes the plaintiff money. And it state with specificity the amount that they owe. You didn't hear that in the complaint, and nor did I read it. Okay? And you know, these banks and these foreclosure mills, they fail to always allege, you know, that they are the holder in due course. As you can see, they say that they're the holder. Well, there's a step above you. That means that when I'm speaking with someone, I want to know who your boss is. Who do you work for? I rarely attack the low-hanging fruit. I want the boss to have the deep pockets. Who is your boss? Who are you working for? In case I bring a counterclaim or I bring an action, I don't want to sue the wrong party. Because the wrong party, like when you're dealing with robo-signers, people say, well, I'm going to sue the robo-signer. For what? It's a $10-an-hour employee. What are you going to get out of the robo-signer? You sue the bank that they're working for, okay? You sue them joint and severally, okay? You want the big pockets. You want the corporation. Okay, you can sue a person in his individual capacity. You can sue an attorney in their individual capacity. You can sue any person, employee in their individual capacity, and you might just want to do it. But you want to go with the deep pockets. Okay? All right? So instead of alleging, you know, that the foreclosure the foreclosure is the holder in due course, which they hardly never plead, okay? They never plead. Then they haven't implied the right to enforce anything about. So they're just saying that you got a loan somewhere, you got it from somebody else, they don't know who they work for, and because you had some agreement, may or may not have had some agreement with somebody else, you need to pay them for it. And the note might have been endorsed properly to them, but then they mentioned Countrywide inside the complaint. Okay? Talking about conflict, I don't know how much apparent it can be. Okay? So, you know, this is a complaint, okay? This is a complaint. And this is a complaint that was drafted by a foreclosure mill, filed in a court. All right, now as you know in New York, when you go through judicial foreclosure, there is a program called RJI. It's a request for judicial intervention. And it's a program that the court has come up with purportedly to help with the backlog of foreclosure cases. And as you understand, the complaint starts off with the attorney law firm filing a complaint and a summons, serving you with it, saying, hey, you have 30 days to respond, answer, or reply, okay, to the matter. Come to court, and you know, let's start litigating the complaint. And as I just read you, based on information and belief, okay, completely ambiguous, completely conflicting and confusing, has been filed against you. So you have to do one of two things: spend your hard-earned money getting an attorney who part of the legal society that wrote this complaint, all right, or learn the rules yourself in time enough within 30 days to be able to defend your property, okay? Both of which, you know, the decision is yours. I'll just say that. So after this foreclosure complaint was filed, you have 30 days to respond. But let me tell you what happened. So the plaintiff, the bank, files a request for judicial intervention, saying that, hey, judge, we want to send this through the program and see if we can work out something, you know, with the defendant without having to litigate. All right? And this is done immediately. Okay? This is done immediately. Okay? Understand, a complaint has been filed against you. They want you to file an answer in 30 days, but then they send you out, and then they want you to go to some residential foreclosure part. All right, which is what it's called, and this is what letter you get from the court, usually within 30 to 45 days. Now, understand, you filed an answer or you may not have filed an answer by the time you get this letter, okay? You may have had time to look at it. You might not have had time to shop for an attorney if that's what you choose to do, but this is what comes from the court, okay? This is what comes from the court, a letter that comes from the court soon after that foreclosure complaint alleging that you owe somebody, alleging that they're the mortgagee, the lender, the creditor, the holder in due course, a gorilla, a monkey, a Sabbath, a disciple, whatever role they decide to play. And they said that the information that they're complaining about is based on allegations, information, and belief. And I explained to you how the attorney who's done a verification that's supposed to protect his integrity and the integrity of the court has said that I swear on nothing. I swear that I did read it. And I swear that I believe that I want to make some money with this bank by doing these illegal foreclosures. All right? So this is a letter you get from the court, not the plaintiff. I said the court. Yes, I said the court. Okay, this is a letter you get from the court within 30 to 45 days before you've done anything. A lot of times you haven't filed an action, you haven't said, I don't know who the hell they are, or I don't have a mortgage. You haven't said, oh, that I didn't sign that note, that doesn't look like something I executed, they're a debt collector. You haven't brought up statute of limitations, you haven't filed a motion to dismiss probably. So you get this letter from the court, and listen, this is what it says. Dear homeowner, all right? A mortgage foreclosure case has been started against you by your mortgage lender. Did you see what they said? A mortgage foreclosure case has been started against you by your mortgage lender. Where I get the stuttering. Where did the court get any admissible evidence or facts? I read you the complaint. How were they able to extrapolate or come to a legal determination or conclusion that the case was initiated by your mortgage lender? Just answer that question. Just hold that in your mind for 1 minute. How it hasn't even been determined that they're a legitimate mortgagee or a lender And even in their complaint, they said they don't know which one they are. All right? But the court's sending you a letter talking about a foreclosure case has been slaughtered against you by your mortgage lender. It is important that you do not ignore this notice. Okay? Sounds like some little force. Sounds like some force, right? And any court papers that you receive or in capital letters it says you may lose your home. Well, it sounds like the court is down with the plaintiff and the law firm and saying that, listen, you know, you got this foreclosure case and you may lose your home. Don't lose any of these papers, all right? You may lose your home. Free help is available, and that free help is going to be the same society that drafted this complaint, not knowing who the hell they are. You should get immediate help by either contacting one of the organizations listed below or by retaining your own lawyer. Okay? Do that at your own risk. There are some good lawyers out there. Don't get me wrong. A settlement conference with you and your lender is scheduled. Okay? Now listen, I just told you this complaint is still, ink is still wet. Okay? It's running off paper, and they've set up a settlement conference with somebody you don't even know. And they've already come to the conclusion, the court, that it's a lender, okay? And you have a mortgage. Wow, all for litigation, right? It says, under the law, and I don't know what law it is because I don't know any law that requires anybody, any defense, any kind of lawsuit, I don't care if it's a foreclosure, a debt collector, I don't know if anywhere in this world, in this country, does a court require you to meet and have a settlement conference? We don't know what the hell you're settling or who the hell you're settling with. And it says a settlement conference with you and your lender. They said they're a lender, although the complaint don't know who the hell they are. All right? You must appear, it says, on February 19th, 2014, at 9 a.m. in the courtroom. And it says you must appear, and the date is in capital letters, is bold and underlined. All right? All right? That sounds like some force. All right? And it says, please call this number 1 week before your conference date to let the court know that you will attend the conference. It's very important that you attend this conference, even if you have spoken with your lender about your foreclosure. And it has required housing counseling meeting, a housing counseling meeting with Brooklyn Housing and Family Services. Has investigation. They are already pushing you in a room to settle with this debt and this criminal enterprise about your property. And they're making it sound like under the law, but they don't specify the law. And I don't know of any law requiring you to go settle with any goddamn body. All right? Set up a housing counseling meeting with you, okay? At a particular time, in a particular place, in room, whatever, in the Queens County Supreme Court, okay? Now listen to this. What to bring to the housing counseling meeting and court conference? It is important that you arrive at the housing counseling meeting and court conference ready to discuss the facts of your case. Now listen to this. The complaint was drafted on information, belief, and allegations. Correct? I read it to you. All right? Yet the court is saying that you got to come to this settlement conference. You got a lender. You got a mortgagee. And you need to show up. And under the law, you must. And then it says, when you come and arrive at the meeting, be ready to discuss the facts. How can you discuss the facts with a freaking debt collector? How can you discuss the facts with somebody that don't have any? What facts are you going to discuss? Okay? And it says, bring with you the following documents. And I'm not lying. I know y'all probably think I'm lying. But this is from not from the plaintiff. This is not the debt collector trying to steer you in a direction they want to go. No, this is the debt collector and the legal society drafting this complaint, filing it against you, and then the court coming in like, yeah, with their spanking and be like, yeah, come on down here to a settlement conference and this other conference and bring with you this, a current mortgage statement for your loan. Well, I thought the plaintiff had that. A current mortgage statement for the loan? Correspondence from lender regarding your past due status. Well, didn't they have that in the complaint? They said they were the holder or the holder in due course or the mortgagee or the lender or all the other many hats that they have. They got more hats than my mom had going to Sunday church. All right? So they said also bring your closing package, including your mortgage, note, riders, HUD-1 statement from last closing. They want you to bring and support stubs for the last...
Good God Almighty, like back in the old days, you know, years ago they had the A&R man to tell you what to play, how to play it, you know, whether it's disco or rock, but we just went in the studio and we did it. We had champagne in the studio, of course, you know, compliments of the company, and we just laid back and did it. So we hope you enjoy listening to this album half as much as we enjoy playing it for you, because we had a ball. Only real music's gonna last. All that other bullshit is here today and gone tomorrow.
All right, I'm back. I'm sorry I got kicked off. Probably a little NSA action there, but we are back. All right, so I'm back to the letter from the court. Take a little break. It seems as though this live stream is not working here. I'm going to take one more quick break, and then we'll come right back.
Good God Almighty. Like back in the old days. You know, years ago.
All right, we are back. I don't know. The information must be getting heated. Had a little technical difficulty there, but we're resuming the call. Hopefully everyone is still here. I see everyone is still here. Let me finish with this letter. So it says, bring with you pay stubs for the past 30 days, W-2s tax returns for the past 2 years, proof of other income such as alimony, child support, disability, leases for tenants, bank statements for 2 months, all accounts, bills, expenses being paid currently, including credit cards, car note, et cetera, most recent property tax statements, credit report, if done recently, hardship letter explaining why you fell behind on the monthly payments, loan resolution proposals, applications, and other information resulting from previous workout attempts. I'm not kidding. The court said that you have to comply by this according to law. You have to show up at a settlement conference with a debt collector who doesn't know who they are, and you have to bring the evidence with you. Okay? Pay stubs, W-2s. I mean, I'm just absolutely flabbergasted over this. All right? So, you know, I'll let you decide yourself what kind of complicity, you know, a court may have, or what's the purpose of this program. And it appears that the program was designed to maybe help a backlog of people that may want to have some mitigation or settlement conferences to avoid litigation. If that's the case, okay, that works out great for people that know they have a legitimate mortgage, that know they have a legitimate lender and mortgagee in front of them, and that wants to go ahead and work out something and do a modification and things of that nature. I'm all good for that, for people that know that they have that situation in front of them. But for you, for the court to make a determination that you have a lender or mortgagee in front of you, all right, and say that you have to go because the plaintiff wants to participate in a judicial intervention foreclosure part conference is just, to me, ridiculous, okay? Totally ridiculous. Before you've had a chance to defend yourself, they want you to come down there and bring all the evidence with you. Now, wouldn't a real, genuine mortgagee have that information? Why do you need to bring it? Pay stubs, tax returns, any kind of begging letters, hardship letters, you begging the court, you going out there to beg for your property that you already own, okay, from a debt collector that has no interest in it. I'm done with that before I get heated anymore. But that's, you know, that's the gist of it. I just want people to be aware to look in your own complaints and see if those defects exist and be able to defend yourself properly against those type things. All right, so we're going to go to the call line. We have an hour left. We're going to go straight to the call line, 412-1568. I'm going to open up your line. Welcome to High Frequency Radio. Do you have any questions, comments, concerns about the topic being discussed or your own personal matter?
Yes, I do. You, wow, you hit so many things. Wow. Well, first of all, I wanted to ask you, I had sent you an email, and the email was in reference to what we had spoke about last week, and it was about the, it was something I thought was law, but it was a bill. Do you remember, you recall that, sir?
I do, and what's your name?
I call myself the perfect black on this show.
Okay. I don't, are you talking about some sort of amendment to 15 U.S.C. 1692?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I looked at that. It seemed to be some sort of proposal, but it hadn't been enacted into law.
Okay. Is there any chance that it may in the future, or is that just dead?
You know, with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, they may start upping the damages on FDCPA from $1,000 to $10,000. Seems, you know, being able to increase it by 10 times doesn't appear to be likely, but I hope so. I mean, if you're dealing with some states like Kansas and Washington, RCW, you know, they have already $5,000, $10,000 liabilities for violations of their consumer protection law. So there's some states that come ridiculously close.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, the reason why I had found that based on some of the things that you had said on the show, and I stumbled upon that, and I thought it was law, so I said, let me, I looked at it and said it was a bill, but I still wanted to send it over to you so you can take a look at that, and I appreciate that.
And I appreciate that.
You know, the one question I wanted to ask you about these assignments, and after the closing date, we're saying that you really can't assign a mortgage after the closing date.
At the closing date of a REMIC trust, you're speaking of?
Yes, sir. On those stock certificates, there's supposed to be like 90 days. They have 90 days to get a closing and a cutoff
right.
date.
Yeah, you have a cutoff date and a closing date. Cutoff date is a time by which no other certificates are going to be given, and then the closing day is actually when the trust closes, meaning that it's a closing, sort of similar to a closing that you did. That's it. It's closed. All right. So they're not able to assign any alleged loans into that REMIC after the closing date, or really the cutoff date. But many times these assignments are done years after, which means that the REMIC really didn't acquire anything. Okay, and under New York trust law, that assignment is void because it violates the pooling and service agreement. That's what you're speaking of.
That's correct. So that New York trust law, where would you find that at? That since, you know, this is mortgage assignment has entered the REMIC, where would an individual find that? There should be
right. You just Google. Yeah, just Google New York trust law. I can give you the specific if you email me, but New York trust law, just Google it. Or if you have your pooling and service agreement, it'll be listed in there. So if you just Google it, it'll come right up, and you'll see New York trust law.
Okay. And like I said, as you're reading this here complaint, I'm looking at one myself. Now, as far as, I mean, when these the courts are trying to get you to contract, to really contract with a debt collector, that's what it sounds like it's doing when they want you to come down there with mediation and bring all your personal documents.
Yeah. Well, no, they're forcing you to. They're saying under the law you have to.
Okay, so my next question would be, an individual should be filing a motion to strike or dismiss that, you know, that case or that complaint.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That should be your first response, a motion to dismiss. And what are you going to discuss in the motion to dismiss? Well, you're going to look at the complaint and you're going to be like, what the hell is the complaint saying? I can't even proffer an answer or an affirmative defense to such conjecture, confusion, and confliction. Who are they? What are they collecting? Who are they acting for? You know, it's so much. you could do a motion for more definite statement. I mean, you could do a variety of things with that type of complaint. Or you could just be like, I don't even know where to start. All right? I don't even know how to answer. If you want me to fill in the holes, okay, for your complaint, and this is what they expect you to do. They want the defendant to come in and start making affirmative defenses that puts the onus on them, okay? And this is done all strategically. It is done intentionally for them to say a bunch of wild things and see what road you take the complaint down, okay? And that's what we do. So this is how we get into subject matter. When I read you that complaint, I know you're not an attorney, you're not a lawyer, you're not a paralegal, but you listen to that complaint in plain English. I mean, it's not, you know, there's some legalese in there. I translated what part was in there, but you understood that complaint. And how did you see that complaint? Was it a bunch of garbage or what?
It's all hearsay. No one has no firsthand knowledge
but,
like
but
the
not even hearsay. Did it make sense to you?
No, it's complete garbage.
Okay.
It's legalese,
okay.
It's legalese, but basically, so the plaintiff, I mean, the defendant doesn't know what's going on. The other attorney may be there, but his job is to make money, period. He don't care about your house. His thing is to,
right.
You know, to pay for his bigger house. And my question
so let me
is,
ask you a question. Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
If an attorney would get that case, what do you think he would do?
To drag it out so he can still get just make money, that's it. These attorneys don't do anything to really stop the foreclosure. Okay?
No, I don't necessarily wholly agree with that. I think a good attorney, and I always say a good attorney, okay, would totally obliterate that complaint. Okay?
Well, how do you find
a good attorney would.
Phone book? I mean, how do you find
you
it?
Know,
phone book?
I mean, that's a question that that's right. I mean, that's right. I think that's a perfect complaint for somebody off of this show, a student that's been studying a little while, to take that complaint and completely shred it to pieces. I don't even think you need an attorney to dismantle that type of complaint. Okay? So this is why the reason why I brought this complaint to fruition is to show people that it's not difficult. I mean, these things are not written so complex. I read you one from a huge foreclosure mill in a Supreme Court in one of the biggest states in the country, and I told you this is what they said, and I'm not making any of it up. So, I mean, you know, who couldn't pick that apart and be like, what answer are you looking for me? Because until they straighten out or I get a more definite statement on what they're saying or who they are, I really can't mount a defense. I really can't have a reply. So, I mean, I'm going to just file a motion to dismiss or a motion for a more definite statement or, you know, something of the sort. You have to be strategic in answering that, but you need to start at that time picking the complaint apart and start showing where what they're saying doesn't make sense, and I can't answer that, and what they're saying here doesn't make sense. So I'm going to answer a question that has multiple parts to it. How am I going to address someone when they don't know who they are? They might be someone else. You following?
Yes, sir. Question, at this point, I mean, all these mortgage complaints and foreclosure, they're all bogus. And at this point, when you're coming in there as a pro se litigant, and right now you have a gatekeeper in front of you, if you're saying that the mortgage assignment is the weakest link, okay, and if it's totally bogus and fraudulent, and it's outside of the closing date and everything, and you file a motion to strike that part of the complaint, because without that part of the complaint, they have no complaint. Now, if the judge doesn't rule in your favor, can an individual object? Can you appeal a motion, or you just have to make a affirmative defense at a trial?
You start laying your tracks down immediately. Because, of course, the lower courts, the trial courts, are going to be the gatekeepers. They're going to try to knock you out. But you need to set your defense to win on appeal, period. And in these type of complaints, the burden of pleading and proving the required elements is on the plaintiff. That's on the bank. That's not on you as a defendant. And it can't be shifted to the defendant without violating the constitutional requirements of due process, period. What they're doing in that complaint is switching it to you and saying, okay, we threw 20 things at you. You pick which one you want to talk about, all right? Which one you want to go on, all right? Which disco light you going to dance under, okay? Requirement of defendant to raise a required but missing element of a defective complaint like that filed by a plaintiff would require you, the defendant, okay, to raise the missing element and then deny that it's an attempt at stating an affirmative defense that raises no issue other than the element that was required to be in the complaint. So, you know, you try to raise a defense, but it's something missing. You can't defend something that's so ambiguous, that's so convoluted. So they try to get you to figure out what they're saying, or you might slip up and fall into one of those traps. They've laid mines, and if you step on any one of them, you're going to get trapped, and you're going to start running on one of their disco lights or dancing on one of their legal disco lights, and you're going to miss the whole point. How can I do a defense to something that's just really, I don't even understand it? So it's a reversible error, okay, in that it improperly shifts the burden of pleading onto the defendant, the homeowner. It requires the homeowner to prove fact mostly, okay, understand mostly that's in the sole control of the plaintiff. Okay, so if all this information is in the plaintiff, well, let's look at this. The court said, bring down all your mortgage closing paperwork, your documents, your pay stubs, and everything. Is that not evidence? So they ask you to bring the evidence to the debt collector plaintiff and do what? There's no need for litigation. Well, why are we litigating if that's what you're requiring me to do?
Okay, but again, can you appeal a motion, or you just have to do affirmative defense?
Appealing a motion, that's not it's not a dispositive motion. We'd be called an interlocutory appeal, okay? And you, in many states, you have to get a permission for that, okay? But, you know, that's something that you're – an interlocutory appeal, something you're appealing a decision that wasn't necessarily a final order, okay? Or you just have to run the litigation and then appeal the entire final judgment that the court may render against you. All right, brother? All right, I got to go to the next call, but I appreciate your call.
Appreciate it.
All right, let's go to 917-1024. 917-1024, you're on a high-frequency radio. What's your question, comment, or concern?
Peace, my brother. You know, I'm the brother.
Peace, brother.
That was I'm the last one on the last call, remember? You got me in
right.
The last minute. I was telling you about the
yes,
fish
sir.
I had on the hook.
Yeah,
and
And
now you see what I'm dealing with in New York, right?
Yeah, brother. Oh, yeah.
Okay. So,
and that's why you should be slaying them if this is the veracity of their complaints. Understand now, I'm going to make this point one more time. The complaint I read to you was supposedly a verified complaint.
Exactly.
And I'll just let you
and
go with
the question. That's supposed to be that new law that they passed where the debt lawyers, actually the debt collectors, pull a verified debt. Is that the verification
that's
supposed to be? That, like
yeah,
said,
that's what it's supposed to be. Right.
And you
don't
see
verify
how the courts
a damn thing.
Are implicit in
yes.
working with them pretty much to
yes.
railroad you in and shuttle the sheep in there and, you know, get into contract with them even if they didn't
right.
write one.
And, brother, let
you
me
know?
Tell you
but
something.
Anyway.
I hear in those Supreme Courts up there, Queens, Bronx, Rhode Island, Staten Island, there's people actually out there with that document that I read to you from the court that's out there with folders, pay stubs, welfare checks, whatever they got, pay stubs, closing dot, all kind of waiting
you know
in line as if you're on welfare to be able to
that's
keep
right.
your house and work with a debt collector. Who's controlling this society? I'll just leave that up to you to figure out. I'll just give you a hint. All of them are part of the same society.
Exactly. And you know what I found out also, based on, it's just business. Remember, it's all business. So with the big corporations, they'd rather not comply by the laws if they're going to make money. Like the pharmaceuticals, you see, you know, a good example, you know, with the, you know, they let something pass, you know, they know they're going to have a couple of hundred million in feedback they have to pay out, but then they made billions. So it's cost effective not to comply
that's right.
and still do what they want because it's all about business. So same
that's
thing
right.
with these
now, brother, I would understand this program if it was after some portion of litigation has went on,
right.
Some identification, some you know, okay, well, okay, yeah, okay, we realize, yeah, you are legitimate mortgagee. Let's go ahead to settlement conference, see if we can work that out.
Oh.
I'm not opposed to that. Okay, I'm good with that. But for them to start off and say, look, come down here and bring the evidence with you because the plaintiff don't have it, and
that's
say under the
say,
law
brother.
You have to, that's just, brother, that's ridiculous.
Remember, they work under presumption law. So
that's
they
right.
presume you're a debtor. They presume you owe. They presume they're going to lend it just because they brought the complaint or whatever.
That's right.
So if you don't rebut it, and rebut it, which we usually don't, you know, we fall into the trap acting like a debtor or admitting to something,
uh-huh.
and they got us. You know, but that's the
that's
bottom
right.
line. But I'm
yes,
about
sir.
To
How's your case
I
going? Uh-huh.
Well, I sent them a letter, and now that I'm dealing, oh, that wasn't just the in-house counsel. That was the senior counsel I got the letter from.
Gotcha.
Think that's a little more pertinent. Anyway, I
that's
sent them
right.
a letter back, giving them my stance, and I found a case from the same bank for in Kansas, and pretty much to let them know they're not to hold in due course and this, that, and they had to lay down a profession. I even had to pay for that, you know, I mean, just to see that, and which was worth it. And a host of other case law, you know, that backs what I was saying and what you were saying about being to hold in due course. They don't even have the right. I think they operate ultra-virously. By, you know, trying to collect on a debt, I mean, you know, as the holder, not the holder in due course, am I correct? And that's
correct.
Where I got them, pretty much. And
good.
I told them, I gave them an offer to settle 10 times the other amount for both of them, for the lawyer firm
okay.
and for them, and, you know, to raise the so-called purported debt. That's my offer to them. And my
okay.
counter or special note to them was if they didn't accept my offer, then I may sue everybody that was complicit, every tortfeasor, and they're going to be the principal, you know, what they call it, vicarious liability these days. They're the
right.
superior respondent. So they're going to get hit with everything, which is applicable
mm-hmm.
by law. You know, I sued 10 people, I went against 10, but you're the principal, I want you to pay for everything I got from everybody. You understand? And I let them
that's
know I'm going for $1 million minimum. So that's what it is. We'll see what happens. Because you
okay.
see how they playing, so now you see how
yeah.
it has to get. You know, I mean, now you see
hey,
why they playing
it's
with them.
Thousands of complaints. Just I mean, these are boilerplate complaints. I mean, I think all of them. I know the verification that I read you pursuant to CPLR 2106 is definitely boilerplate. Every attorney files that, and I dismantled that for you. But these complaints are that whether you're dealing with a credit card complaint or a foreclosure complaint, they all have the same material, latent, and obvious defects. They all do, upon information and belief or upon hearsay, none of which should win you a judgment in favor of a debt collector.
Two things. I already had a Supreme Court judge help the corporation rob me. That's the one I'm going after his oath, his bond for breaking his oath. I got a judgment in my favor, then he overturned himself. After they came illegally and put false instruments on the record. So, you know, we know how to get down. And this is Kings County, Brooklyn Supreme Court. All right?
Oh, okay.
But
and that complaint I read you was from Queens County.
From Queens County, right? In Queens, right?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. It's next door. Earlier you was talking about instruments and discharging and all that. I did discharge some credit cards effectively with no problems. You know, you're going to have mixed some. I think the more professional ones, they'll accept it, deal with it, no problem because it's the law. Others, either they're not used to it or they're going to find it, all the banks. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. I
but I did do at least $40,000, no problem, with one creditor or alleged creditor. That was American Express. And they even gave me a check back for overpayment. Okay?
Okay.
And that's the way you're supposed to do it. But you're not supposed to cash that overpayment check for it rolls out there if they get it through with that, because then that shows you're trying to gain. You understand? Then they lock you up. You understand? You're not
right.
supposed to do that. So
in other words, when you're using each instrument, you should make it for the face amount of the debt.
Right. But sometimes it's a little, you know, because, you know, they increment, you know, charges here and there. It might. So you got to guesstimate it a little over or near as possible. You know what I mean? By the time it gets there, because it's always accruing with them, with the credit, you know what I mean? So, you know, but either way, just don't cash the payment checks. And then that shows you're trying to gain that, you know, that would constitute fraud. Anyway, that's where I'm at.
All right, well, I appreciate that, brother. You know, again, I don't know about these processes, but it's good to hear, you know, somebody's done them. I don't know what the end result is going to be, you know, just like some people that's done the OID, sometimes it takes years to come back.
That's what I did.
Right.
Discharge to a closed, it's an offset to a closed account.
Okay. All right, brother. Well, good luck. Appreciate your call, and have a great new year, brother.
You too.
All right, let's go down to 443-3477, 443-3477. You're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question, comment, or concern? 443-3477, do you have a question, comment, or concern? All right, let's go to 404 down in Georgia, 1031. 404-1031, do you have a question? High Frequency Radio, welcome.
Yes, greetings. How are you today?
I'm doing well.
How are you? Pretty good. Kenny from Atlanta, Georgia, spoke with you earlier. Yeah, I just went to my county court and pulled all my records. I didn't know that I was missing out, pulling out all of my records when I've been going there the last few years. But I went there yesterday and pulled all my records and found out that the Homeowners Association got a lien on my property. And that's since 2011, and I didn't know about it. And I've been sending them administrative letters for the past couple of months, few months, to validate their that I have a contract with them, and they've been ignoring my letters. So I found out, I said, maybe that's why they ignore my letters, because they already got a lien on my property. So can I go after them the same way as with the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, file a lawsuit on them the same way I want to do with a foreclosure?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up, because this is another area that is quite concerning to me, where we have homeowners associations that really serve as sort of mini governments. I mean, requiring you to pay, you know, for certain landscaping or certain other very vague things that they may offer, and we're paying several hundred dollars a year up to thousands of dollars per year to have a government in our community telling us, hey, you can't paint your house that color and you can't do this and your mailbox is leaning an inch. I've sued several homeowners associations and won every time. They do become subject to the FDCPA. Okay, that's one. And many times if you look up the Homeowners Association, there's a lot of times there is a homeowners association and then there's a management company. So if the management company is collecting for the Homeowners Association, then they're a debt collector. Okay. If the Homeowners Association is dealing directly with you, then they may be a creditor, but they still come subject to the FDCPA. Now, with the liens that they have, you know, most declarations and covenants allow a homeowners association to sui sponte put liens on your properties. They're supposed to notice you, though. In every one of those declarations and covenants, there is a notice provision in any law that you have to send certain notices as a condition precedent. You have to send certain notices. You have to make people aware. You have to respond to notices that they send. That's all in your covenant, in your declaration. You need to find it. I completely obliterated a homeowners association for $5,000 just on a $500 alleged homeowner due. I mean, they're very sloppy. They are easy targets. And this is another area that is concerning to me, because they have the ability to foreclose. And you have homeowners associations in many states foreclosing for a couple of $1,000, okay, in homeowners dues and gaining real property in amount of $100,000, $200,000, $300,000. All right, and then you have a war out there that many of you may not know is going on between the homeowner associations and the banks. Let me also share this with you. The homeowners association was getting so confident and so corrupt that the government, the Justice Department, went after in Las Vegas 50 homeowners associations and charged them with fraud. And I think they settled for somewhere $50 million. They sued 50 of them because what they were doing, being that they know that the banks were owning these corporations, was owning these properties, they were just attaching all kind of stupid, ridiculous, inflated, excessive fees, and knowing that the banks were going to pay them. And the banks were paying them to avoid foreclosure of the properties. So the Justice Department got involved and brought an action against, I mean, they were, you know, some of these homes, you know, as they go through foreclosure, were owned by Fannie Mae, was owned by Freddie Mac, and they were just bilking them for, I mean, millions. I mean, they were just throwing those fees up, saying the grass ain't been cut, that's $100 a day. You know, they didn't, bail boxes lien, and that's against the covenants. So they were, I mean, they were milking the banks until the Justice Department came in and filed suit against about 50 of them. I'll find that action, and they settled with most of them, but they went, they went straight to their ass. And got these homeowners association, caught them red-handed, you know, inflating fees and whatnot. So I don't know if that particular action started to make these states look at the whole legality of homeowners associations, but they have way too much power. They really do. And I don't know who created that power, because it seems like, again, another way for the state or some, and the homeowners association are private entities. So you have a bank and another private entity that's never loaned you a dollar that has the ability to foreclose on your property, which is ultimately ridiculous. So, yes, you should go after them. And let me tell you something. Let me tell you what I caught in a case that I did, okay? I found that the lien was defective, okay? It didn't comply with, I believe you have the Georgia Property Association Act down there, and then they have another way that they can institute their declaration and covenants by not using the Georgia Property Owners Association. So a lot of times those liens are defective because there's certain restrictions that they can do if they're going under one law than the other. They're usually very sloppy. These homeowners associations are usually ran by one or two people, and they can't keep up with 100, 200 homes. So you can catch them slipping very easily, and that'll be a good small claims case for you to bring to get your feet wet.
Yeah, okay. All right. Okay. All right. Well, good. I appreciate that. They sent me a letter telling me to tear down my tool shed. I built a tool shed in my backyard that didn't require a permit or anything. And they said if I don't call, the homeowner association wanted me to call the management company and to get permission from them. So I sent them a validation letter, and they've been ignoring it. And so, you know, that's why I wanted to find out what to do about that.
Again, I explained this to you, and I want everybody to understand. When you send a debt collector a validation notice, that doesn't mean they have to respond. If they're continuing to collect that debt before validating or verifying, then they violate it. But if you send them a debt validation dispute and they stop and cease and desist trying to collect that debt, then they haven't violated. But if they still have a lien existing on your property and you sent them a debt validation dispute, not only are they in breach of their declaration and covenant, but they're in breach of 15 U.S.C. 1692, the FDCPA, because that lien operates as a form of collection. Okay? So you need to look into that. All right?
Right. Okay.
All right, brother.
All right.
Thank you for your question. Have a great New Year. All right. All right, let's go to 267-3782, 267-3782. You're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. I apologize. You just kind of gave me the answer. I heard it at the end. So I'm fine.
I love when that happens.
It's long.
Okay. Did you have another question or did I answer it?
No, I'm cool. Thank you, Islam.
Okay, thank you. Have a great New Year. All right, let's go to 443-1257. 443-1257, you're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. Hi, Brother Sharif. This is Pamela from Maryland.
Hey, Pamela.
I want to ask, I have several questions and two comments. The first question is, in filing a complaint, what if the bank or debt collector is no longer in business and we have to file it to the resident agent, but they no longer exist? That's the first question. The second question ties into that. What if the bank or debt collector is in bankruptcy? Can you file a complaint on an entity that's in bankruptcy? Those are my first two questions.
You can, upon belief, file. What you do when they're in bankruptcy is you need to file some sort of adversary proceeding or proof of claim, because in every mortgage or deed of trust, it states in there that if you were involved in any litigation that would affect the interest of the property of the lender, you would notify them, and vice versa. If they were involved in any type of litigation, i.e. bankruptcy, that would affect your lien interest in the property, then they should be notifying you. Okay, so you can do a proof of claim and go in there and be like, you know, this entity purportedly holds an interest in my mortgage, and I'm filing a proof of claim. Okay? Now, let me tell you what else that I've been successful at doing is getting a stipulation and agreement from the trustee of that bankruptcy. And what that stipulation agreement is to avoid an adversary proceeding being filed against them, which is a complaint saying that, hey, you know, I want to know if you really own my mortgage. What did you do with it before you went into bankruptcy? Where is it? Who owns it? You know, a lot of times they don't want to go through that, and they don't want to get a claim. So they'll give you a stipulation agreement, and that'll say, and it'll be signed by the bankruptcy court judge, and it'll say, look, we don't have any interest in your mortgage. Go ahead and do what you got to do. We don't have any interest,
okay,
or we sold our interest to a particular entity, and you know, we don't have it. So here's a order. The judge will sign it. We'll send it to the court. The court will agree with it and be like, okay, we don't have to litigate any of your claims. We don't have your mortgage. We sold it, or we don't have anything to do with it, and we'll give you an order saying that we don't have anything to do with it.
Okay, because this particular debt collector is showing up, and it's GMAC, is showing up on my credit report, but they're in bankruptcy, so I wanted to know what
yes.
avenue or options that I have.
Yeah, a lot of GMAC assets has been sold to, I forget the name of that company.
Aquin.
Well, wait a minute. You know what? I'm glad you brought up Aquin, because there's something I wanted to discuss, and you're a blessing, because I was off track. I wanted to tell people about the validity of a FDCPA complaint and share with you a case that's old. I mean, it's from 05. It's long ago. But I want to share two things about Aquin, because Aquin, as I stated, is the Pookies of the mortgage servicing industry and debt collectors, and you know they're debt collectors, all right? Aquin had a case, and the name of the case, all right, it was in Galveston, Texas, of all places, okay, Aquin Financial Group, all right? And it was a case with Aquin, the name was Sealy, S-E-A-L-Y, Davis versus Aquin. And what happened was, in short, this homeowner had sent the payment to Aquin. Aquin was fumbling around with the payment like they do with your modification paperwork. And, you know, they sent their payment in, and they said, listen, they haven't sent the homeowner a payment statement. I guess they were in between servicing, transferring servicing, and, you know, the homeowner was on top of it because they didn't want to be late. So they sent the payment in. They didn't get a response from Aquin. They kept sending their monthly payment in. One payment they returned and said, look, we don't want the payment. We're starting foreclosure action. And Aquin is good for that. Okay, they'll have a payment and start a foreclosure action. I'm telling you, they are the worst out there. So anyway, yeah. They went on ahead and foreclosed on Sealy Davis, start the foreclosure action. The attorneys, although they paid every payment, okay, and it was over one payment, they were saying that they lost or they didn't have it. They were playing those games. And so Mr. Sealy took them to court under the FDCPA, okay, and the result was $11.5 million in damages was awarded to that person. $11.5 million.
I have a court appearance Monday. I have a court appearance Monday for Aquin, because GMAC sold a lot of their bulk loans to Aquin, and
yes.
being abreast of this, I filed a quiet title. And Aquin, in turn, saying that we do not service a loan, we don't know, we're paraphrasing, we don't know what she's talking about, blah, blah, blah. So I submitted in my exhibit the welcome letter, the payoff letter, and the payment
uh-huh.
statement that they sent to me, and asking them to prove this debt. So the counsel that they have said that we need to dismiss this case because it's a frivolous lawsuit, and I just resubmitted my information, and I go to court Monday to argue this particular case. And it's going to be very, very interesting. But ironically, my friends who also had GMAC loans, I was telling them what to do, the same thing that I did. They did not do it. And in a matter of 2 months, Aquin did assignments on all of GMAC loans having mirrors as a nominee.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, you're dealing with the thugs of the mortgage servicing and debt collector industry in Aquin.
Right.
Recently, to be
right.
honest with you, I know I talk about a lot about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and Richard Cordray, which heads that particular bureau, and they're the police of the debt collecting industry, mortgage service industry, and things of that nature. Recently, just last week, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau hit Aquin with they have to pay $2.1 billion okay, dollars over mortgage servicing abuses. Okay, they took advantage
wow.
of borrowers at every stage of the process, and that just happened last week. okay? So, you know, although, you know, these things provide some evidence and gives you some history to be able to speak to the court about, and because, you know, when you get arrested as a criminal defendant, first thing they do is what? Bring up your record, okay? So you can go to court and say, that, look, they got a civil record that's horrible. These guys have been convicted of several crimes, $2 billion, an $11.5 million judgment, and thousands, maybe millions of complaints against them. So I wanted to let the court know they got a record, and they got a horrible record. So you want to start gearing that court towards don't believe anything they say. They've been convicted of this. They got hundreds of lawsuits pending. They've made hundreds of settlements. I mean, you have to bring up the entire civil record of these entities that you're dealing with. But $2.1 billion just for taking advantage of people is pretty substantial. So, you know, but that's nothing compared to how many houses they've stole. Okay, how many billions or trillions of dollars they stole? Okay, $2.1 billion. I mean, they can do that in, you know, 100 houses. Okay, and they probably conduct thousands of foreclosures every day, every month.
Exactly.
Right.
So when the bank is no longer in business, I mean, when I called the Department of State for the due to business search on an entity, they advised, or the individual I was talking to advised, just go ahead on and send it to, because I have their name and address. He said, just go ahead on and send it to them and just let it, you know, fall where it may, but just so that it's on the record that you did send it to them, who was previously the resident agent.
Okay. Now, when you say resident agent, I think you're a little bit confused. A registered agent is what I believe you're trying to say.
Registered, correct.
Registered agent is an agent that exists in the state. When you file documents to form a corporation in a state, you have to have a local representative, otherwise known as a registered agent, to receive service of process and any other communication. So if that entity is in compliance, okay, and they're licensed, or their agency hasn't been revoked, then they should have a current registered agent if they're doing business, but they may be out of business. So if they're out of business or they're not doing business in that state, maybe they might not be doing business in that state, and if it's an entity, look for it in a state where they're headquartered, and then find that registered agent and serve them if you're trying to. But if the company's out of business and the registered agent is gone, and I don't see what reason you're trying to sue them. You can't sue somebody that's dead.
Okay, so that was my question, because the registered agent that's listed, they have another name, but they just added holdings on the end instead of Inc.
Be careful, though, okay, because this is another trick that they do. They play games, musical chairs with those names. Like you might have ABC Corporation, Inc., and then you might have ABC Incorporation or ABC LLC or LLP. Okay? You have to be careful that you're suing the right party.
Correct, right.
And a lot of times they'll pay with those. A lot of times in these complaints you'll see that. It'll say ABC Corporation. Okay? And you have to be smarter to say, okay, who are you acting for? ABC Corporation, are you an Inc.? Are you a LLC? Are you a LLP? Are you a trust? You follow what I'm saying? Be careful, because if you go and try to sue those entities, they intentionally don't put their names correctly, so you can't find them, all right? And I'm telling you, it's a trick that they do often, so you can't find them. You're like, I need you to identify, where are you organized, where are you formed? What state are you formed under, okay? And you have to do your due diligence and find out where they are.
Something you touched on today, I wanted clarification on the holder versus the holder of due course. If the holder of due course, again, is the lender, no longer the business, that has the financial interest, but the holder has a 5% interest, can that holder still foreclose on the property of, let's say, $150,000,
$200,000? Okay. If I'm what they call in street terms money bags, right? I'm the money man, right?
Uh-huh.
And I hire you to go out, I had 100 loans, and I go out and I hire you to just, you know, check on the people, go by the house, collect payments, send out Merry Christmas cards, whatever. And I say, listen, I'm going to let you hold this note right here for safekeeping, for safeguarding or whatever, but don't do anything unless I tell you. The holder in due course has to be the one that's taken the action. In your mortgage documents, it will almost always say that the lender is able to commence foreclosure action. The lender can accelerate the loan. The lender can issue a default. It doesn't say anything about a servicer or a holder.
Okay.
It says lender.
Okay.
In fact, most of your mortgages and deed of trust don't even use the word holder or holder in due
right.
course. It says lender.
Right.
That language comes from the UCC. Okay, holder, due course. It says lender. So if a servicer sends you a letter saying that they're going to take an action, that's a violation of the FDCPA because you're threatening to take an action you can't take. Now, if they write you a letter and say, hey, the holder in due course, Brother Sharif, said that if you don't pay by tomorrow, he is going to accelerate your loan, that's okay. Okay? But if you go and you say, hey, listen, I'm going to go ahead and accelerate your loan. I just don't like the way you looked at me, and I'm the holder because Brother Sharif let me hold this stuff, but I'm going to go ahead and take an action without getting permission from him. Okay, that's not an action that you can take. So, you know, your contract calls for conditions preceding for them to do certain things, issue certain notices in compliance with law and in compliance with the contract that they're purporting to be acting upon.
Okay, okay. And lastly, my two comments was that your first caller mentioned anything in reference to the closing date and the cutoff date with the trust. And I wanted to just put out there that there was a case that was ruled on this year, as a matter of fact, called Glasky, G as in golf, L-A-S-K as in kilowatt, right, versus Bank of America, that ruled in favor of just that action. So I just wanted to let him know. I didn't know if he knew that. And I'm the one that's having problems opening up the webinar, first webinar. I can't. Could you resend it to me? I can't open it.
I will.
And that's it.
And I'm glad you mentioned the Glassy case. I mean, the Glassy case was good, except if the court still misconstrued, the governing laws governing REMICs. Because in the Glassy case, they said that the assignment, in part, they said that the assignment was dated wrong, but they said that the trustee could issue that assignment. That is not that is not true. The assignment has to come from the depositor, okay? So the court still got it twisted, and I think it's intentional, okay? Only the depositor assigns the loan to the REMIC, not the trustee, okay?
That's
just period. Only the depositor does assignments to the REMIC, not the trustee. And to be honest with you, a trustee can't initiate a foreclosure. Only the servicer, if you look in your pooling and service agreement, the master servicer or whoever the master servicer hires to do the servicing. So, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions out there, but I always tell you the confusion benefits them. So, you know, even in the Glasky case, although it was a good ruling and they fought like hell to get that decision overturned, to get it quieted, shut down, put into a safe, put into a vault, sent overseas underwater, and they was unsuccessful at doing that. But even in that case, the court still got it wrong with regards to, in respects to what a trustee can do as far as an assignment. An assignment cannot be executed by a trustee, only the depositor.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you very much for the information.
Well, thank you
so
much, and have a great new year. And I'll get that webinar over to you. You too.
All right, thank you very much. All right, bye.
All right, God bless. All right, two more callers left. We're going to go to 412-3671, 412-3671. You're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question, comment, or concern?
Hi. Yes, I do. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm fine. I just have a question to ask. What it is that how can a tax attorney that is a debt collector file a lien for the county or city in the county or city's name, and under the Fair Debt Collection Practice Act says it needs to be in the debt collector's name? So is it yes or no? I mean, can they do that? And who would the lien be with?
Okay, that's pretty much a loaded question. You know, when it comes to taxes, and I always say, if you are a taxpayer, and a taxpayer is a legal description or definition, if you are a taxpayer and you consider yourself to be, and that is true, and you owe taxes, you need to pay it. Now, it sounds like you're talking about property taxes, and this is one of the issues I try to discuss with people, to pay your taxes. That's going to be a hard hill to climb when you're dealing with taxes. You know, taxes for these counties purportedly are for schools and, you know, your other amenities that one gets when they're a resident of the state. So how an attorney files a tax lien, it's easy if he's working on behalf of the state. And as you know, the FDCPA doesn't apply to state officials, okay, or state entities, okay? I've heard some case law, and I think I've even seen some that people use the FDCPA against the IRS because they're working for the Treasury Department. I haven't really dove into that information. I've heard those defenses. I don't know if they work or not. I heard there's some cases out there. I don't know if they are or not. But when you're dealing with those taxes, it's a lot of information you have to acquire before trying to go on the defense. So it's best to just pay your taxes if they're due. Okay, and then study more about what taxes apply to you, even at a county level, and do your land search and your title search to see if, you know, those taxes were somehow avoid based on your property search, based on a proper title search, on a proper land title, all right? So, but an attorney working for the state or, you know, I don't know. I don't have the document you're talking about. I don't know what the lien was for. I don't know who filed it and why they filed it. But an attorney can file a lien for somebody if it's a, you know, genuine, you know, perfected lien. He can file it for anybody, as long as that person he's filing it for actually has a lien interest. Okay? So that can be done. But if you feel
it can
that
be done.
You've sent... Yeah, if you feel like the lien is not correct, the amount is not correct, then you need to challenge that. One of the things I tell people when cleaning up their credit is a lot of times you'll have IRS liens on your credit. Okay, and what I teach my student is that IRS liens can't be verified. Okay, and that's a cause of action under the FCRA because a lot of times they will exist in your public records, and you'll see tax lien. Well, what you do is you got to understand that the IRS doesn't file any tax liens with the credit bureaus, okay? They file a tax lien with the county, okay, but that is a public record. That is not authenticated. It is authenticated for purposes of the filing of the lien. But all you got to do is dispute it because they have LexisNexis and other corporations that go to the county and they get all that information on liens. They bring it back to the major credit reporting bureaus, all three of them, and they match that up with a name and address, and they put it on your public record. But the thing is if you dispute it, they would have to go, and they would say, their response is, well, it's at the county. Okay, well, maybe you already paid the lien, or maybe you wasn't a lien at all, or maybe it wasn't a perfected lien. Who's going to defend that? Well, the court is going to tell you, well, we didn't provide that information to the credit bureaus, and the IRS is going to say, well, we didn't give any information to the credit bureaus. So they're taking hearsay information that may be flawed and defective, that may be not accurate or not true at all, and they're taking that upon themselves, the credit bureaus are, to report that information in your public record that has a disadvantage to your credit scoring and your credit buying ability, all right? So they're taking that information. So when you dispute it, let me tell you how they can never verify or validate it. Then what are they going to go back to the county record? If you say, well, I dispute that. I dispute the amount. And there's no creditor in there. It just says, well, this is a public record. It's at the court. Okay, well, I'm telling you that the court said they didn't report anything, and the IRS hasn't notified me, and they're not reporting anything. So how do you know what kind of tax business I have with the IRS? So I'm telling you to validate or verify the information and conduct an investigation pursuant to 1681-2B. Okay? So you're telling them to go verify the information. Where are they going to go? They can't call the IRS and get the tax information, right? Unless you give them an affidavit or a power of attorney to do so. So can they go to the IRS and say, hey, do they owe a $15,000 tax lien? No. So in other words, they can't verify or validate the debt. It needs to be removed. And that's how I get tax liens removed. Because they can never validate that debt. And the court's not going to validate it, and the IRS is not going to talk to them about any of your proprietary tax information. So they need to remove it unless they can verify it. They just can't point to the court, and you go down to the court and be like, okay, well, the court said they ain't reporting nothing. So the court's not taking any liability. I know you didn't get the information from the IRS because they don't report anything to you. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So how you sue them under the FCRA.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, let me ask you this. Once they go and, you know, and file whatever documentation they need, do they assume the debt, the assignment at that time?
On a tax lien?
Mm-hmm. Do they assume the debt? I mean, if they are acting on behalf of whomever, and they say that there was the debt assigned to them, and are they responsible?
When you're talking about assignment, usually, you know, if the county is doing a now, if you have a tax sale and someone has bought a tax certificate, yeah, they're holding that debt, and you have to pay them interest and everything else to be able to recover that tax certificate and pay them an amount. Now, banks are heavily invested in tax sales, okay? Why? Because they know when you don't pay the tax, and I just read you a complaint where they say, hey, I might have to pay property taxes, all right? So, you know, mm-hmm. they're very much invested. If they don't get you over here and the homeowner association don't get you, then they'll get you at the tax sale, okay? They'll wait for you. They'll set you up, too. They'll stop paying your taxes when you think they're paying them, which is why I tell people to pay them. They'll stop paying your taxes and go to tax sale, and they'll just buy your house for $5,000, all right, and then kick you out of it if you don't pay them, or pay them, you know, $10,000 after it's all said with their interest and fees and costs, all right? So you have to be careful. We're dealing with multiple issues here where we can have our property taken, and it's unfortunate, but we have to learn how to defend all of those attempts that are out there.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for the information.
Thank you
have
so
a
much.
Great day.
You too. All right. We have 15 minutes left. I'm going to try to get to all these callers. I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm going to try my best. All right. Let's open up 412-3671. 412-3671. You're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a quick question? I'm sorry. It's 301. Where am I? All right. I'm sorry. Let's go to 301-5355. 301-5355. Do you have a question?
Yes. CC, Sharif. How you doing, brother?
Peace, brother. Good. If you can turn down the background noise a little bit, I can hardly hear.
I'm sitting in a damn Starbucks, man. Let me see if I can step out. Let me step out here. Is that a little better?
That's a little better. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Okay. I had a show cause hearing in my car case because I'm the plaintiff Ford Motor Company Ford Motor Credit called me into court for this what's called a show cause hearing.
Sure.
And I sent a debt validation letter to the attorney. And which he didn't respond to, well, he did respond to it, but he responded with a photocopy of a title and a photocopy of the sales agreement.
Gotcha.
Now, what I found out is that in Maryland they have like this catch-all corporation that represents. You know, big corporations. It's like this law firm that covers all of their stuff, right? Okay, but it says on the paperwork that Ford Motor Company is suing me, but the correspondence is coming directly from this guy. So in the letter he responded to me, the debt validation letter, he responded and says. Yes, we are attempting to collect the debt. This firm is a debt collector. So I was like, cool, okay. So the show cause hearing was on the 27th. My question is, have you ever had a judge try to flip a hearing that the plaintiff calls and make it seem like it's you that's calling it, or that they're there because of you? So that's what happened to me.
Well, I don't know, but I would have to look at your paperwork and be able to see, you know, a show cause hearing is a determination hearing to see what show cause why something or another shouldn't happen or occur, or why, you know, maybe you brought up a defense and you maybe challenged some of the evidence, so the judge wants to have a show cause hearing to make a determination of whether evidence is admissible or whether you have the right plaintiff or party. There could be some affirmative defense that gave the court some sort of instruction to have a hearing to sort of sort out something that may not later be overturned on appeal or anything else. So, I mean, a show cause hearing is not bad. If you're saying that you know, you didn't call it, you maybe didn't call it. Something in your pleading probably made the judge want to hold a hearing to make some determination of fact or something. All right?
Okay, okay. So, okay, now since you said that, now it makes a little more sense. Because he struck, because I just filed, I just put on the record that I have made the death validation request with this attorney. So mm-hmm. so the judge was saying, well, why did you put this on the record? This isn't a motion. This isn't a pleading. I say, I understand that, Judge. I put it on the record so it wouldn't be said that they couldn't say that they never received a correspondence from me. And he said, this isn't the way you're supposed to do this. I'm like, I don't understand. I'm putting the court on notice prior to coming here.
Well, maybe
know.
You didn't do it properly. I mean, and you know, one of the methods that I use is putting a notice of dispute on the record, but it is a notice. And anyone can file a notice, okay? I don't know if you just put something that he felt wasn't germane to the case or wasn't relevant, or maybe you did it in the wrong way, maybe your format was wrong. You know, you have to do it in proper format, and it has to be a notice, okay? And you can file notices with the court, but you need to make it kind of neat and make it look kind of good, and so he'll understand what you're doing. It's a part of your pleading, Judge. I want the court to know that I disputed that, so I wanted it on the record, okay?
Right. That's basically what I said. He said, you didn't put this in the form of a plea or a motion or anything like that.
Well, maybe you did.
I said,
I didn't
know I had to entitle it a certain way. But it was obvious what it was. I confirmed what it was.
Right.
He struck it from the record.
Right. A court is able to make a determination with a pro se litigant. Okay. Their pleading should be construed liberally. Okay, so in other words, we have a pro se, you know, you can't hold them to the same standard. They got to play by the rules. That's why I tell people you got to learn your local rules and your federal rules of procedure so you can know how to do certain things. But a certain amount of leeway is given to you most of the time by a pro se litigant that they have to look at the content of the pleading, not the title. So say you put a motion for a more indefinite statement, but the content of your pleading was something else, then the court has to construe it as what the content of it says, although you might have got the title of the document wrong. Okay?
Okay. So in
all
order
right,
for
brother,
me
I gotta,
to get in
uh-huh.
Okay, so
go
in
ahead.
Order for me to get this information in the record that these people have been put on notice that I'm trying to verify this debt. How
you just send them a certified letter, certified registered mail. Just leave it a case alone if you don't know how to put it in a notice form that the court will accept. Usually, if you file a notice, the court's not going to say anything about it. All right, but I got to go to the next question because your background noise is pretty high. All right, let's go to 678 down in Georgia, 5157. We got 7 minutes left. I just want to let the listeners know, don't forget about the webinar, January 11th, 2014. Myself and Brother Alicia will be holding a webinar. You can get on the mailing list at thelawmaster44@yahoo.com or highfrequencyradio@gmail.com. Please go ahead and reserve your seats for that webinar. It will be explosive. All right, 5157, do you have a question?
Yes, quick questions. Greetings.
Sure.
I'm looking at a notice of sale under power. It is signed by Wells Fargo Bank, N.A., as attorney, in fact, for, say, Joe Blow. My question is, how effective do you feel it would be to file a revocation of power of attorney to terminate the granting of the attorney, in fact?
I've seen those. I would say they don't hurt. Okay, because you can always revoke power of attorney. I would say that if you're going to do that, maybe look into whether you should file that in the county so it would be a matter of public record and just send certified registered mail to the attorney that's purportedly acting under power for you. I would say that doesn't hurt. I would say it would be more strengthening if you did that within some sort of judicial action that you took against them and put that notice on the record that you revoke any and all implied power of attorney, and that would be more effective.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
All right, I got 5 minutes left. I'm going to try to get to a couple more of these questions. Let's go to 703-1169. 703-1169, do you have a quick question?
Yes, I do. I just paid off my home, and I wanted to know, what should I do in order to gain or to get the deed of it so that it's definitely mine in case anything happens to myself or my wife? Is there something I need to file? I mean, just to make sure that house and that property is definitely in my possession.
Okay, so you said you paid off your mortgage. Did you get a satisfaction of mortgage?
I'm assuming, I did get that. And they just sent me they call it a certificate of deed. I think that's what they refer to, but it's not the actual deed. So I don't know if the county's still holding it for another purpose, or I mean, should I get it? But the home has been paid for. I've received the notice, and it's been satisfied. I just want to make sure that if something happens to me and my wife.
All right. Well, if you receive the satisfaction, okay. And I can answer you quickly. If you paid the mortgage off, hopefully you paid the proper party that can issue a perfected satisfaction of mortgage or lien or whatever have you. But if you've done that, then and it's listed and filed in the county recorder, and then your property is clear. You need to look into putting that property into a trust or an asset protection vehicle, or look into an estate, get with an attorney, and do an estate or will or whatever have you, that in case that property, in case something happened to you, that, you know, it would be left for your wife or however you want to do it.
Okay. Now, as far as being a trustee of a property, because there's an attorney's name on it as being the trustee, should I change any of
that? Yes,
attorneys
serve as trustees. If you have a deed of trust state, yeah, you can have an attorney as a trustee, and a trustee is the one that usually does deed upon sales or does satisfactions and liens. So, yes, that would be done by an attorney if they've been substituted as a trustee or served as a trustee on the deed of trust.
Is that something that I should change in case someone tries to put a lien?
You can't change
property?
That. No.
You can't change that.
Why
would
you
need to
put a lien? No, you've satisfied the lien. Your property is clear. You just need to decide what you're going to do with it, put it in your wife's name or put it in a trust or put it in some asset protection vehicle, and you're fine.
Okay, that's a question for you. Is there any way someone else can try to put a lien on my house or something unrelated to my property?
Yes, if you owe a debt, they can put a lien on the house if they obtain a judgment on a debt for in your name. They could lien your property. That's why I always recommend you put your property, I don't care what it is, okay, your motorcycle, your car, if it's clear, you need to put it in some asset protection, because what an attorney or anybody else do is they're going to look at what assets you own before they bring action against you to see if it's beneficial.
Gotcha. Okay.
So don't leave property out there with your name on it. We're too much wanting to own everything. You don't want to own anything. You want to control everything. Okay, you want to asset protection all of your assets and protect it. So when they look you up, they don't find anything in your name.
Gotcha.
All right. Thank you, Brother
P. Much.
All right. We're going to take one more quick question. I got 2 minutes left. I'm going to end the call once the live stream is gone. And we're not going to go over. So let's go over to 314-4222, 314-4222. You're on High Frequency Radio. You got like 1 minute to get a question and answer. Do you have one?
Yes, Brother Sharif. This is Carl of St. Louis. I appreciate your time, and I hope to condense this and make it concise.
Sure.
I have a first mortgage, a second mortgage. The first one has been transferred 3 times. I declared, and MERS I believe, on my note, I can't verify that at the moment. I did declare Chapter 7, discharged both the first and the second. I did not reaffirm. I'm continuing to pay the first and the second. When I call the first mortgage company, they say they're trying to exercise a lien against the property, not a lien against me because I've been discharged.
Okay.
And
I'm going to go over for you to address your question. Just want to let the callers know the live stream is going to end in another minute and a half. So if you want to continue to call and listen to the answer to the question that the brother here is posing, you can remain on the line or call in, but you have to call in before the live stream ends. So you had 2 mortgages, the first and the second. You did a Chapter 13 You didn't reaffirm.
No, chapter.
You went
chapter
on
seven.
And you didn't do chapter seven. Okay, you didn't reaffirm. You didn't do an adversary proceeding or a complaint to determine the validity of the lien, which would have challenged any alleged lien interest that they had. So what they're going to do is, and I don't know if they within your case file a motion for relief from stay. I don't know what they did in your particular case. Yes, okay, they did do that, I'm sure. So what they asked the court was for relief from the automatic stay so they can go ahead and proceed with foreclosing. But what you did by operation of law is the bankruptcy after discharging, okay, the bankruptcy court, it serves as a permanent injunction against any payments made on the note. But they can still go ahead and enforce their perceived or alleged lien interest, meaning that they have to do an action just on the lien, and they can do that. They can still foreclose. You don't have to pay them a penny unless you want to, but they can still foreclose on their lien interest or whatever alleged lien interest. That's why when you do bankruptcy, you should go ahead and do an adversary proceeding in some form. You need to list on your schedules the debt as being disputed, unsecured, and let them prove with a proof of claim that they have a debt lien or they have a mortgage.
Okay.
If you didn't do that, there might be a possibility that you may be able to go in. If there were some unresolved issues with your discharge, you might do a motion to reopen the bankruptcy and make those challenges or, you know, consult with an attorney or bankruptcy attorney or some other group that might be able to consult you and see whether you can go in on another bankruptcy and do an adversary proceeding. But just doing these BKs, people would understand it that, you know, you do a BK and all is gone. No, I mean, it's just – that just extinguishes your obligation to pay on the alleged debt, okay? But it does not. If you have a secured loan, they can still come after whatever portion is secured, whether it's your car, whether it's your house, whether it's a motorcycle or whatever. If it's secured, which is why you have to have someone professionally do your schedules, okay, or have an attorney or a bankruptcy preparer that's licensed with the court, do your schedules and do your bankruptcy correctly. I see a lot of people do bankruptcies and don't do them correctly. All right, or they don't get advice on doing them. They just think, you know, you can file five pieces of paper, a petition, and a couple of things, and then all your problems are gone. No, it's not. I mean, they're going to come after their secured amount or what they perceive as being secured. So you use the bankruptcy and all the tools within it to do an adversary complaint and make them work for whatever lien interest they have.
Okay, so the key term is adversarial complaint.
Yeah, adversary complaint. And what you need to look into is a complaint, the name of it, write it down, a complaint to determine the validity of the lien. So basically you're telling the court, look, I don't think they have a lien, and I want the court to determine whether they have a valid lien, okay? And that's just a simple complaint. I mean, that's it. I want to see if they got a lien. If they don't have a lien, then I need the court to go ahead and get rid of them. They're unsecured. And after the bankruptcy has been extinguished and discharged, they go away just like Walmart and Discover and the rest of those guys do.
Okay, so I could do that even after have been discharged for 2 years, you're saying? The complaint to determine the validity.
Yeah, you need to look into. You need to consult counsel or a bankruptcy preparer and see, you know, what justification you have to file another bankruptcy. Possibly you'll be able to do that, and or you might be able to reopen your old bankruptcy if there's some unresolved issues there. I don't know how you handle it, so I can't say specifically. But yeah, those avenues you can look into. You might have a cause of action to do those things.
Okay. Well, I did pay an attorney to get that done, and I'll proceed with that. However, MERS is mentioned in my note, and I found a case law here in St. Louis against Aquin that is paralleling my situation. It said that Aquin versus Balinstri, B-E-L-L-I-S-T-R-I, said that Aquin didn't have standing to foreclose because they didn't own the note. Because MERS do not have the rights to assign the note to
them. That's correct. Now, most of your assignments you'll see with MERS, there's even cases out there that say they can't assign the mortgage. But, you know, most of the times out there, what you will see is either one or two things. You'll either see clear evidence of bifurcation, meaning that MERS might be assigning the mortgage but not the note. But we all know the note holder owner is the most powerful person in the mix. So, and a lot of times you'll see Mercer sign the note, but they're never listed on the note. They never have possession of the note. And if you go into Mercer's rules and regulations, they will tell you he never holds any notes. So if you have that situation to where they've assigned just the mortgage and not the note, then they haven't done anything. Or if you have a situation to where they're assigning the mortgage and the note, then you don't have anything because you know they don't have the note. Okay, so you have to look at those things and you have to decide whether bifurcation is there, and that's not just something that's independent of itself that you can get relief from. You have to, you know, pull together your case and say that, well, Merce really didn't assign anything because they didn't own the note. And without knowing who the note holder is, this debt is unsecured for purposes of bankruptcy. Okay, it is unsecured, disputed, and I'm going to file a point to determine the validity of the lien, meaning that the instrument says that Merce assigned the note. We all know Merce don't have the note. So I need you to go ahead and go on and wash them up in bankruptcy court and let me leave with my property free and clear.
Okay. All right. I appreciate your time, and thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a great New Year.
All right.
I'm going to finish up these calls. Let's go to 404 Georgia 1948. Georgia 1948, do you have a question?
Yeah. Good morning. Well, good afternoon. I appreciate all the information that you've been giving out.
Thank you.
Better than last week. And I really appreciate the information you're giving out to all the high frequency member family, USS, you, Paul, everyone listening. Have a happy new year. I just picked up your first webinar. I'm going to continue studying that later on today as I finish your show. And I was just calling to say thank you. That's it. Peace and love.
Oh, brother, I appreciate that, man. And that means a lot to us. I mean, it really means a lot. I'm glad that you are blessed by some of the information or it's able to prick your conscience or educate you in some particular way. And I appreciate you just calling in just for the purpose of saying thank you. That means a lot to me, brother, and I appreciate it. And you're welcome.
Okay. Peace.
All right. Peace. Thank you. All right. I got two more callers. I'm going to go through them. Let's go to 973-2909, 973-2909. You're on High Frequency Radio.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon.
I'm a new listener to High Frequency Radio, and it's been very informative. I'm just trying to find out if you've ever done any shows regarding predatory lending with student loans and loan modification practices.
Yes. You know, student loans are subject to the FDCPA. If you go on my last show last week, I spoke a lot about student loans and Sallie Mae and those entities that was really doing all of the student loans and how the government got involved when Mr. Obama came in and he, you know, took the middle people out, got rid of Sallie Mae and just said, you know, your loans now come straight from the government because they were losing a lot of money. You know, people like us and other groups out there and other entities out there was, you know, challenging those student loans, challenging who the real creditor was, challenging who really made the loan, challenging, you know, the amount that's owed, okay? They do come under the FDCPA, and you need to do a vetting process and find out, okay, who are you acting for? Okay, who made the loan?
I'm trying to search for my student loan now. I have a son that took out a couple of private loans, and he was unable to finish school. And I'm trying to search for my own student loan right now, what I actually put in forbearance. How it ties into real estate, I'm in a situation where my mother died. And my share of the estate, my siblings has been requesting that I either buy them out or just automatically just purchase properties. They've actually allowed the properties to go in the hole. The state has been diminished significantly. So I'm looking at all these different things, and nothing is making sense to me. If I had to go and borrow against my current property, which I have a modification on it, I'm not really sure what to do because I know I have the student loan situation hanging over my head. And I don't know if a bank would even consider lending me the money that they requested. So to make a long story short, I'm just trying to find out where do I start in terms of gathering all my information so that I could, you know, dot my I's and cross my T's. Because I know somewhere along the line I'm going to be held liable, whether it's in the form of legal fees or I'm going to be I'm going to be held liable in the form of buying out my portion, because if not, the estate is just going to sink to the ground.
Right. Well, I mean, yes, you got to do your due diligence and find out who you owe, and you can use your state consumer protection laws, you can use the FDCPA, and if they're reporting to your credit, you can use the FCRA and start doing a reinvestigation, meaning that you're disputing with the three major credit bureaus, you're disputing under the FDCPA, meaning that you sent them a notice and request for validation and or verification, use your state consumer protection laws in conjunction with the federal laws, okay, and just ask them, who did I get a loan from, how much do I owe, who are you? Okay, are you the creditor? Who made the loan? And how much do I owe? And ask those questions. And within those answers, you are going to find, just as I read you this complaint, really a lot of flaws. I've had clients and people that I've talked with that had a lot of money in student loans discharged because they can't prove the debt. And that's why the president came in and he cut out those middle people, because they were losing too much money. Okay, as you know, most of these loans are government-backed.
I am trying to prove the debt, because I know my student, I never had a problem with debt until my son went to school, and we co-signed on a loan to him, and then he started to take out his own loans with just the strength of us co-signing. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it started to tumble down on him. Now, besides of that, I have my mortgage. And we refinanced at one point and got some money off the mortgage just to, you know, put some equity in the house. You know, they call you with these great deals to lower your payments and X, Y, and Z. Now I'm at a place right now where, I want to get everything together. I just need to know, like, what's the first thing I should do? Should I contact the credit bureaus? Should I contact?
Okay. I would contract whoever's sending you requests for payment. Okay, I would do a dispute online with the credit bureau.
No one is, at this point, we pay our mortgage on time.
All right.
At this point, in terms of my student loan, no one is sending me anything. The only person who gets calls regarding their student loan is my son, which he's starting to pay back on it, or if he doesn't pay it on time, they call my husband. They don't even call me about my student loan altogether, so I don't know where it is.
Okay. Well, that's why you have to ask those questions. You need to email me so I can go further in depth, because, like you said, you are new and you need to know what letters to send out. Just email me and maybe I can help you with that further.
Okay. Could you give me your email?
All right. TheLawMaster44@yahoo.com.
LawMaster.
TheLawMaster44@yahoo.com. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I really appreciate it. You know, this show is very informative. I'm definitely going to go back in the archive, because I'm watching a situation now where, since my mom died, months after my mom died, a loan showed up on one of her properties. And whoever contacted my brother, who was acting in the form of the executor of the estate, my brother was never able to give me concrete information, plus he was trying to withhold details from me. But I know that somewhere along the line, that irresponsibility on his part, we're all still going to have to be faced with it. Because there's a loan that's out there outstanding on one of the properties, which is part of the estate. I know that he's not handling that situation correctly. So I need to be able, when the time comes, to go in there with enough knowledge under my belt to be able to handle things. Because this particular loan that, you know, I've heard about through the grapevine really doesn't make sense to me. Because my mother was very meticulous about paying her mortgages, paying her taxes, and paying her bills.
All right. Email me, sister, and I'll go further into that, because you got a variety of situations, and I'm not going to be able to answer your questions in full.
Right. I do
need to email me, and
maybe
set up a consultation. Not a problem. Not a problem at all.
And when is your next webinar, you said?
Webinar is going to be January the 11th, Saturday at 10 a.m.
At 10 a.m. On this same
ma'am.
Show?
Yes. If you contact me at the email address, you'll get information on it.
All right. Thank you so much. I do appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the knowledge.
Uh-huh. Not a problem. All right. Let's go to 917 New York 4210. 917-4210. Do you have a question?
Peace, Brother Sharif. I just wanted to interject. When they send, say, in the complaint that they have the original documents, and then somewhere in the lawyer's statement, they say the documents are destroyed or damaged or cannot be found. How do you link those two things? And them putting those things into the court, what stops them from doing that? I know you said New York is a notice pleading state versus a fact pleading state, and that's
correct.
My question. Yeah.
Okay, say the question for me again, for me.
In the complaint, when the attorney
uh-huh.
drafts that complaint, and they
uh-huh.
say that the note, the mortgage, or whatever it is available in its original form, and they have that. But then somewhere in the lawyer's statement, they say the note has been destroyed, damaged, or doesn't exist. How do you relate those two statements in their plea, in the complaint, and their verification?
Well, it's a contradiction.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, sure.
Right.
It's a contradiction.
No,
they have to do a lost note affidavit, and they have to mm-hmm. prove that the debt was valid. They have to prove all the contents of the note in order to be able to file a claim on a lost note. Okay, but if they say they have the note and they're subject to payment, but then they say they don't have the note, then you'd be like, what note? What note are you talking about? If you don't have it, what note? I don't remember executing a note. I don't recall executing a note. What loan? I don't remember ever getting a loan from that particular entity. So you have to look for the conflicts, and you need to be able to narrow them down and be able to expose those conflicts for what they are and say, this is not a complaint. This is a bunch of garbage. They said they have a note, but then they lost it. Well, if you lost it, which one? Did you lose it? And what did you lose? And prove to me you ever had it. Okay, and you were ever subject to payment, and you were ever the holder in due course, okay? So, in other words, if you were a holder and you lost the note, it wasn't yours to begin with. But if you're a holder in due course, then you should have filed a lost note affidavit, okay? Or you should have pled that the note is lost, okay? Most of those lost note situations I see in Florida, I don't see in many other states, but sometimes they do come up. So you just have to expose those with common sense and say, do you have the note or don't you? Well, we got a copy. Okay, well, I don't recall that copy. So I need that to be authenticated. You need to prove to me every element of that note and its contents to be able to prove that I owe you a debt. Did you get that?
Yes, I got that. Thank you, Brother Sharif. That's my question. I won't hold you.
Okay.
That's it.
All right. Thank you, sister. All right. All right, last call. We're going to go to 202-8200. Do you have a question?
Do you have a question?
8200-202. Do you have a question?
Do you have a question?
Peace, brother. No,
all right.
I don't have a question. Right. I just want to say thank you
oh, okay.
for all your service and peace to God.
All right, brother. Peace to
all
you,
right,
too.
Brother.
Thank you.
Thank
all right,
you.
That concludes all of our questions here. I'm glad I was able to get through all of them. And hopefully, the answers, my opinions, provided some sort of insight or direction by which you can follow. Again, welcome to High Frequency Radio. This is a Tuesday night call, Brother Sharif. We're having another webinar on January 11th, 2014. Get on the emailing list so you can be apprised of that webinar, when it's occurring, and what it's about. I want to thank everybody for a tremendous year. Hopefully 2014 will have you be more informed and educated on being able to protect your assets, your property, your income, your credit by this show. Although this show got started on the latter part of the year, I'm hoping this had a tremendous effect on the people's minds and the listeners' minds to be able to understand that they do have affirmative defenses, and even in most cases are able to turn alleged debts into assets and cash by way of the behaviors of the debt collector. All right, I want to wish all of you a very, very happy new year. Godspeed and blessings. Thank you for joining, and we'll see you next year.
Baby squirrel, use a sexy motherfucker.
Give me your attention, baby.